And welcome everyone to a brand new episode of the DKB here at WrestlingObserver.com and F4WOnline.com. We are here for a very special show today because I've been theorizing something in my head that I've just kind of been trying to formulate really some thoughts around. It's something I've been thinking about for a while. And I want to do a show on this thesis, so to speak, that I have. And who better to have on to do this show with me than internationally acclaimed broadcast journalist and the motherfucking guru of grappling himself, Mr. Joe Lanza. Joe, how are you?
Now that is a proper introduction of a man of my stature. And I think you need to have a little chat with Rich Kreach to get him on board with how to introduce a man of my stature to a podcast. That was tremendous, Alan. Thank you very much. I gotta tell you.
Got you fired up.
Yeah, I think this is my, third or fourth time on this show.
And yeah, we definitely did a New Japan G1 or Year in Review show. We did the draft, and we did a show about 80s tag teams. I think there might have been one other, but those ones definitely.
Yeah, and I ask you the same question every time I come on this show. This is Dr. Keith Presents. Is Dr. Keith ever going to be on this show? or is he simply the presenter at this point? I mean, what is going on here?
He's the sponsor. He's the founding father. He's the spirit that guides us. He's all of those things. And he'll drop in from time to time. Like, at least a yearly appearance, I would say. I should probably check in with the good doctor and see if he's AAW announced their on-demand service there this week. So maybe we could get Keith on to do some little plug ski for that, and well involved in that product.
That would be something amazing if the man would come on his own show and for the first time in ages to plug his own product.
It would be perfect. Keith would be able to do it in a manner that only Keith can do. And were you a big PPH listener back in the day, Joe?
Was I a big what listener back in the day? You broke up a little bit there.
The PPH.
I don't think so. I don't recall.
Okay, so Dr. Keith would have been. Would you have been listening to this show before I was on here?
Maybe a couple of times. Okay. I do recall listening to this show a few times. I don't know what you were referring to before that, though.
Yeah, because Dr. Keith is like Dr. Keith, Mike Sempervivi, Zach Arnold, Adam Summers. That was like the Peresu Power Hour. That was like the original. There were no podcasts going back in 03, 04, 05. That was really, you had that and you had Observer Live airing on Sports Byline. So like that was when I was like kind of getting online looking for wrestling things to listen to. PPH, I was just getting into Japanese wrestling, so it was perfect for me. But the shows were like, they were like 3 to 4 hours minimum with at times in various segments just dreadful audio quality that you didn't really think of as being dreadful back then, but if you listen back now it's like, oh my god, how did I ever listen to this? But yeah, they were my introduction to Japanese wrestling. They guided me by the hand through the stormy waters of mid-2000s New Japan and the glorious waves of mid-2000s pro wrestling Noah.
So what you're saying is these are the men, the trailblazers, the men who paved the way for thousands of shitty wrestling podcasts that followed. So in a way, we can blame these guys.
Yeah, and Joe Gagne, we have to blame him a little as well for Joe versus the World.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
And another pioneer.
It's all your fault, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. Timestamp this motherfucker. Grabs crotch.
You know what's funny is you had me rolling on the floor before you hit record because we have this enormous ground to cover in this show.
And we haven't even said what the topic is yet, but go ahead.
This giant philosophical topic, which it can delve a million different ways. Then you invite the most long-winded person in the podcast world who loves to hear himself talk on the show to talk about this topic. And then right before you hit record, you say, I'm gunning for about 60 minutes.
I said an hour to an hour and a half, but that was more because so I just wanted to give you a window to say, like, oh, I got to be out of here in an hour. I wasn't really thinking that we were actually going to only go an hour. I'm fully settling in for the 2 hours here, at least.
We've already blown 10 minutes, and people don't even know what they're listening to yet, so you might want to clue them in.
Let's introduce, and as good an introduction I did for you, I forgot one key element, and that is, of course, you are representing the fine website, voiceofwrestling.com, where people can listen to your great podcasts with Rich and other podcasts and great G1 articles and all the good stuff that's up there, and I'll let you do the full plug for that later. But just wanted to mention, for anyone who's not familiar with your good self, Joe, that's where you hail from. But okay, so my concept here, my thought, my idea is that so when I think back to 2006 and when the Dragon Gate professional wrestlers came into Ring of Honor, came onto the American soil for the first time, and just tore the place apart with the six-man tag and the various other matches over the course of WrestleMania weekend. And people's heads were spinning. This was like something certain hardcore fans in America, like, who had seen it all, they were like, what the hell is this? This was incredible. This is something I couldn't even envision. Just total wow factor stuff that came up into their world that they were not really thinking too much about, and then it just blew them away. And that kind of thought of, I need to seek out more of this. This is so different. This is so new. This is so innovative. All those kind of things. And if you look back through the history of wrestling, or at least the past couple of decades, as we'll kind of handle, there have been various different points where something new came up to us. Oh my God, this is revolutionary. This is new. That same kind of reaction. Since that Dragon Gate, since Dragon Gate came into America and had that big breakout, I don't think there's really been, at least for me and from what I can see with other people, unless you're someone who's just completely kind of shielded from different types of wrestling and you just, like, I don't know, took up watching Japanese wrestling this year or something like that. But even still, I don't think there's been that kind of a thing to come along to really wow people with being completely revolutionary. People might think off the top of their head, oh, Lucha Underground, that's different because, okay, they're doing a different style of production. I'm talking more in-ring, just really an in-ring product that is something unlike anything you've seen before or had even conceived in your head. And I have a couple of thoughts as potential reasons for this. The first is the globalization of the world. I'm gonna go real theoretical with this. I think with the world getting smaller, people being more connected, you can, Joe, watch wrestling from Europe as easily as I can watch wrestling from America. We can both watch wrestling from Japan as easily as someone in Japan can watch wrestling from Mexico. And likewise, all the wrestlers can all do that as well. Just go on YouTube, go on Dailymotion. The world is a smaller place. Whereas 20 years ago, you had pockets of wrestlers and wrestling fans in different parts of the world who weren't familiar at all with what other wrestlers were doing. So you could have people come in with a style that had never been seen somewhere before and blow people away. You could have someone doing something completely different in one part of the world that's just, yeah, just unlike anything people have seen in another. So that's my one kind of thought about why this could be the case. And my other one is, and people may disagree with this, but I just think the Dragon Gate, the apex of Dragon Gate, because, I mean, if you look at Dragon Gate in 2006, 2007 versus what it is now, yeah, there's certain things have kind of been taken up a gear a little bit, but in general, it's no more jaw-dropping now than it was 9 years ago. I think they were really the ones to finally push the athletic art of wrestling as far as it could go. I don't think there was any further you can go from what the Dragon Gate guys were doing in the middle part of the last decade. The envelope had been pushed as far as you can take this art from an athletic point of view. And I think everything from Japan, Mexico, just general athleticism all pulled together and just came out in the wash is what the Dragon Gate product was. And I don't think you can come up with anything crazier or faster or more innovative now. So yeah, those are kind of my long-winded thoughts on this subject. So I want to kind of go into a bit of the discussion of the thesis itself. And then what I think the bulk of the show will be about is kind of looking at over the past couple decades, the different things that have popped up that have kind of shook the world, the wrestling world in this way and made people go, oh my God, this is crazy. I've never seen anything like this. So we got a few samples of that we'll talk about. But Joe, your thoughts on all that.
Okay, I disagree with one of your theories there, and I strongly agree with another. So I'll start with the one I agree with, that the world has gotten smaller, and it's hard. We're all exposed to everything. Even the smallest independent promotions, you can watch their – I'll give you an example, and this is not to put down this promotion in any way, but there's certainly not a large scale promotion by any means, even on the indie level. But a promotion by the name of NWA Smoky Mountain, they've got their shows available less than 24 hours after they occur, available online for like $1.99 or whatever the price is. I don't know if that's amazing to me, and it just goes to show that whether it's WWE or Ring of Honor or New Japan or NWA Smoky Mountain, if you want to watch something in 2015, if there is a will, there is a way. So you're absolutely right about that. I think, fans who have that will and have that way, and wrestlers themselves where it used to take them months to get tapes, or if they weren't into the tape scene, they weren't seeing things unless they worked on the same shows as certain people. That has all changed. You can watch anything you want pretty much at the snap of a finger, which is crazy. And it all happened, so fast because, as little as, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, if you weren't heavily into the downloaded, the seedy underbelly of the downloading scene, with seeders and feeders and all sorts of other things that are loaded with innuendo, it was hard to find this stuff too. So you're right about that. The world is now, look, man, you're sitting in your den in Ireland. I'm sitting in my living room in America, and we're recording this podcast. I mean, we're all next door neighbors now. The theory that I disagree with slightly is that Dragon Gate has pushed the boundaries as far as they can go. I never believe in that. I think you can always go further. I do agree that we haven't seen anyone come in and start that next eye-popping, holy shit revolution. And we're going
to
run down.
I'd love to think you're right. I'd love to, but I just can't conceive. I just can't see how it could be possible.
Well, see, that's a dangerous statement to make, because I'm sure in 1880, there were people saying, that's it, guys. We just shit cannot advance further than it has now. We've got stagecoaches. This is amazing. And it's like there's always something else coming down the pike. And even athletically, I mean, just look at athletic records. Every time you turn around, someone's setting a new record in the 100-meter dash or the high jump or, whatever else you want to bring up. Will we ever reach a point where a record is unbreakable? I don't think so, because why? If you can do something in X amount of time, why can't it be done a hundredth of a second faster? So I don't believe, bringing this back to wrestling, that there isn't something out there. And the reason that we can't conceive it is because it doesn't exist. I'm not sure that in the 1960s anyone could have conceived what Dragon Gate would be doing, 40 to 50 years later, because someone would have done it. So, I don't believe that. I think there probably is something coming along, and it's just we can't conceive it.
Where I have difficulty is not in the idea that we're going to get better at, because I think if you look at some of the athletes in terms of athleticism for pro wrestling, like Ricochet, ACH. people like that who are around now, compared to those guys like in that Dragon Gate six man, for instance, I totally believe the standard of the best athletes in wrestling has gone up a huge amount. But where I struggle is I just don't see ways of applying this new athleticism in wrestling. That, and maybe, like you said, maybe there, I can't see it because it hasn't happened, but I just struggled to see how you could apply it in any ways that weren't applied by that Dragon Gate style and kind of what that Dragon Gate style brought about.
Well, you know, it all depends where wrestling is pulling their talent from too. I mean, because I'm not sure that wrestling is getting, the elite of the elite and the top tier athletes for us to be able to answer that question. You mentioned Ricochet and ACH. Obviously those guys are incredible athletes, but they weren't high level athletes in any sport, at least that I'm aware of. From what I know about their background, something I brought up, we cheap plug here, but myself and Rob McCarron interviewed Matt Cross a couple of weeks ago.
Very good interview.
Yeah, he came on to plug what's the name of Lucha Underground's bit? The Ultima Lucha, correct? So yeah, he came on to plug the Ultima Lucha, and I asked him a question, and I once interviewed independent wrestler Bolt Brady, who also had a gymnastics background, same as Matt Cross, and I asked him the same question when I interviewed him. And I really feel like gymnastics is such an untapped pipeline for pro wrestling, because you look at gymnasts and they have everything you need: core strength, pound for pound strength, athletic ability, everything that a great gymnast needs to have translates perfectly to professional wrestling. You know, the guys in the Dragon Gate six man, guys like Ricochet and ACH, you know, tremendous athletes. But are they the elite of the elite? I don't think so. That's why I don't think that we have pushed the boundaries as far as they can go. What if we were tapping those pipelines and getting the best gymnasts in the world to become pro wrestlers? I mean, you know, we've got Johnny Mundo, we've got Bolt Brady, we've got Brian Alvarez, you can't forget Super Chico, we've got Matt Cross. Other than that, I mean, you could literally count the gymnasts who have come over from that world to pro wrestling on
Brady Boone.
Yeah, on one or two hands you can count them. That's the scary thing, is we can run all of them off. So that's just one pool of talent. I mean, pro wrestling has always, they've gotten their, from amateur wrestling, obviously, professional football players. We've mined, those caves plenty, but there's so many other pools of talent and guys that bring different sets of skill to the table, to where I think if we start mining those guys and drawing from those pipelines, we could see new things.
Do you think that WWE being so much so the worldwide leader now than ever before, like the they are the clear number one worldwide, more than any company has ever, like, they're the driving force. Like, yeah, the likes of us are big into New Japan and all these other promotions, but I mean, the average person just sees wrestling as WWE, and I think I'm not so worried about people in their 20s and 30s who have some semblance of a memory of ECW or WCW or trading Japanese tapes or what have you. But people who are like kids now, or were just kind of getting into wrestling a few years ago, when they think of wrestling, or if they go to become wrestlers, a lot of them just see wrestling as WWE, and that's a very homogenized style right now. Do you think that is going to stunt the ability of something to come down the pipeline, wherever it may be in the world, that completely wows us?
No. Because, all right, I'll tell you why. Because you laid out on our little show plan here about seven of the major benchmarks of things that came in and blew everybody away and then were influential from that point forward. All seven of those things were non-WWE sort of revolutions that eventually made their way to the WWE. So,
but they were able to make their way because they were able to go through an ECW or a WCW cruiserweight division. Like, there was the other things out there in the mainstream that they were able to kind of go through, which you don't really have now.
That's true, but I think that we'd then be delving into an entirely different conversation of, do you think at some point in the future that they truly will be the only game in town? I don't think that's ever going to be the case. I think these things are going to ebb and flow, you know, forever, long after me and you are gone. You know, so I
and as long as the recruitment is like it is, where they are taking people from all walks and actively seeking out guys who have different backgrounds, as long as they're bringing in the Devitts and the Kevin Owens and people like that, then we don't really need to worry about that. But,
and just how and look at how often they themselves change their minds. I mean, in the last 6 months, it was, you know, do your own recruiting. Then it was farm the indies. Then it was, no, forget it. We're not going to farm the indies. It's like, you know, they can't even make up their mind where they want to get their own talent from. So, you know, and I look, there's always going to be people out there who are going to try to promote pro wrestling, you know? So, I don't think it, we're ever going to see a scenario where they're truly the only game in town.
Well, let's dive into some of our benchmarks here, as you put it, Joe. Early 80s, something that is lauded historically. Everyone kind of knows about this as a big, famous aspect of the genre in the early 80s. You got a lot of people who dig really deep into the pro wrestling, kind of going back and watching things, who would say now that a lot of this stuff is overrated or it was sloppy or what have you. But it is no doubt legendary. The early 80s New Japan Junior scene, headed, of course, by Tiger Mask and Dynamite Kid, something which was revolutionary at the time. I'm sure I wasn't born yet. I can't really attest to that. But I do know that we have a ton of wrestlers that have come and talked about how it influenced them. And when you look at, like, the mid-90s and, like, tape trading, that stuff was obviously highly in demand and still seen as innovative then, 10 years later. So, Tiger Mask, Dynamite Kid, Fujinami I'll throw in there because I've watched a lot of his stuff from that time recently, and he's just phenomenal. Gran Hamada, another guy who was a purveying of some, we'll talk a bit about him again later. That junior scene in New Japan, that was, compared to what was going on in America at that point, that was pretty mind-blowing, I'd imagine, for anyone that saw it.
Yeah, Black Tiger, you can go on and on. But, that, obviously, we still feel ripples from from that era today. I mean, you know, there's independent wrestlers who emulated Dynamite Kid from that point forward right through till today. There's independent wrestlers breaking through who are emulating Dynamite Kid who don't even realize they're emulating Dynamite Kid, who may not have ever seen a Dynamite Kid match and they have no idea that they're copying the guy. And in Japan too, I mean, that completely changed, that era completely changed the junior heavyweight style forever. And kind of branched out into some of the other things that we're going to talk about. And, you know, and really, it's all about the Tiger Mask Dynamite Kid matches. And I know that that's going to make some people groan, throw their laptops or their phones through the window as they hear me say that. Because in recent years, there's been kind of this movement that those matches weren't quite as good as they were made out to be at the time. There were other matches at the time that were better. There were people who innovated long before Tiger Mask did, yet he gets all the credit. The bottom line is this. I don't want to, you know, this isn't the right show to get into that debate, but when it comes to anything, wrestling or otherwise, it isn't always who's first, but it's who makes that first impression. And I think there's no argument to be made that the Dynamite Kid Tiger Mask matches, no matter where you fall in the debate of who came first, who innovated best, who was cleaner in the ring, forget all that. They made the strongest impression, and they made the impression that lasted throughout the decades. It wasn't Gran Hamada. It wasn't any of these other guys on the fringe. It was those two men. And I'll tell you, it's you said you weren't around at the time to be able to tell whether – I mean, all you got to do is read a lot of the early newsletters from that era and things of that nature, and you can see that it had a tremendous impact on people in real time as well. And, you know, when they brought those matches to the United States, they got over very well. So, I think you picked a really good starting point with Tiger Mask and Dynamite Kid.
Have you – when was the last time you'd say you watched any of their matches?
It was one of – I watched when they rolled out New Japan World – The first thing I dove into was some Satoshi Kojima, because as you know, there's no bigger fan of Satoshi Kojima than Joe Lanza. I think he's one of the most underrated wrestlers of this era. But the first project I really took on was rewatching all of Tiger Mask stuff, starting with the Dynamite Kid matches. Now, I think at the time, you know, they keep adding stuff and taking stuff away. But at the time of the rollout, I think all but one or two of the Dynamite Kid matches were on New Japan World. So I watched all those, and then I chronologically watched the rest of Tiger Mask stuff in that era. For the first time probably in, I don't know, a decade, really sitting there and doing a focused watch. And for me personally, it holds up just fine from the first time. Because the first time I saw that stuff, probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years after the fact that it took place in real time, it blew me away. And it blew me away on the rewatch. I mean, a lot of people shit on those matches, but, you know, I firmly believe you put those Dynamite Kid Tiger Mask matches in Reseda, California right now, and those guys get over. I mean, you know, they were doing stuff that was so far ahead of their time. And to me, I still enjoyed them. Have you watched them?
Yeah, I don't know if I watched them all, but definitely since New Japan World came on, I've watched a couple of them mixed in with my Fujinami watching, which I was pretty heavy into a couple of months ago. The thing I like about them is, as great and as innovative as they are, it's the intensity and the wildness and the recklessness, and yeah, that leads to the occasional fluffed kind of spot that doesn't maybe look as smooth as you'd want it to, but I don't know, I find the matches just really exciting, and the pace they go at is, it's incredible, and I think if you were to see that, you said like 7, 8 years after they happened, I can't imagine someone in 1991 America who's used to Ultimate Warrior and people like that on their TV, and then they see this, and it's just completely another world. For me, it holds up just fine. I think I probably prefer the Fujinami matches I've seen now, but that's just more because of what my kind of personal preferences are right now at this moment. But yeah, I think me of 5 years ago, I probably would have preferred the Tiger Mask Dynamite Kid matches, but not a whole lot of difference.
And you can see how they slapped people in the face when they saw him. It is 1982! 1982!
I mean, crazy.
And you know, and I like how you brought up the intensity of the matches. And you know, the one thing that strikes me, look, Tiger Mask won most of the matches. And what I really like about him, watching him in hindsight, was the level of frustration that Dynamite Kid shows in the matches. That, you know, he goes toe-to-toe with this guy, but this guy always is always a half a step ahead of him. He's always a little bit better than him. And, you know, the psychology match to match, which they don't get enough credit for. I mean, Dynamite Kid gets progressively more frustrated with this dude as they move along in the feud if you watch these matches in order. And I think that's something that neither one of them get enough credit for. But in terms of the topic at hand, the influence of those matches is something that no one would argue with. Even if people have problems with the quality of the matches, I don't think anyone can make a reasonable argument of the influence.
Our next kind of watermark thing that came up and made people's heads spin, both for quality and also for, I would say, social reasons, quite frankly, it's an area I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on, but the mid to late 80s rise and boom of Japanese women's wrestling, the Joshi boom, led by Chigusa Nagao and Linus Atsuka, the Crush Girls, and their various opponents, of which I didn't realize how young she was, a like 13, 14-year-old Bull Nakano at the time, just crazy how young this girl was as a monster heel in this promotion. This, when you mentioned like going back to newsletters, if you look at what people like Dave Meltzer were writing about this stuff at the time, it was clear this was just seen as the most amazing, shocking thing that was happening in pro wrestling. And he would be flat out saying that this was just so light years ahead of and better than the wrestling that was happening in America and a lot of the male wrestling in Japan at the time. This was just, I watched a few of these matches recently, and the first thing that struck me about this kind of Crush Girls era stuff, at least what I saw, the production on this stuff from like 1986, 87 kind of time, the production is amazing. It feels like you're watching something from 9, 10 years later, and it's like a really good show on a really good network, real good production on a very high video quality version of it. But it's from 8, 9 years before that, and it's really, really impressive. But that's a side point. The action is, they work so hard, and there's so much intensity. There's that word, again, that we use for Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask. There's so much intensity with these girls. It honestly looks and feels like they're in a real fight with each other. And I wrote about this in my, I'm writing my diary, of course, for my greatest wrestler ever research, putting up those blogs on the Fight Game blog. And I'd love if people checked out my last one, because I talked a lot about Joshi and that. And, yeah, just the way they scrapped and clawed at each other really felt real. But in addition to that, you just had a lot of high-impact, fast-paced maneuvers and technical maneuvers that you really hadn't seen a lot of to that point in pro wrestling. And the way they were dishing out these moves on each other, it was pretty spectacular. And it had a lot of another thing about it, which I definitely made it different, but I wouldn't necessarily class it as a positive, is it was full of the tropes that we see in Dragon Gate over the years, with the rampant interference and referees kind of just looking away, pretending they don't see stuff, just that kind of suspend your disbelief shenanigans going on, the dog and pony show, if you will. A lot of that kind of stuff was involved in at least in some of the matches I saw. But yeah, incredibly crazy and amazing for its time.
The heels were so hateable. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of times wrestling heels are not hateable, especially now. That's a big problem. The heels in the early Joshi were so hateable for some of the reasons you just said, the rampant interference and just how nasty they were. And you know,
and the names, Dump Matsumoto, Bull Nakano, whoever was coming up with these names, like, when you look at the names they're throwing out in NXT right now, whoever was coming up with these names in All Japan Women need to be hired and given that job, because that is how you name a fucking pro wrestler. Dump Matsumoto. Not like Cherry McDaisy or whatever they're calling people in NXT. Dump Matsumoto.
Yeah.
That is a name.
Yeah. It's Bailey doesn't quite compare to Bull Nakano. I mean, it's not even close. But yeah, I mean, I kind of jumped on Joshi a little bit later, the Manami Toyota era. And then I kind of, when that era faded is when I faded, and I haven't followed Joshi on a day-to-day basis since. So I'm about 20 years off the pace when it comes to Joshi. But I was all in at that point in time, towards the end of the era. And really, what you point to at that time is they really set the pace in terms of doing cramming as much offense into their moves as humanly possible for the time that allowed. Much more than the men during that era, like you mentioned earlier. That was really the start of that. And again, that's a style that a lot of people don't like, but that's also a style that a lot of people really dig. And that really – I mean, you look at a lot of the modern New Japan matches now with the amount of offense they cram into these closing stretches and whatnot. A lot of that started in that era of Joshi. I mean, you know, with the Manami Toyota matches and whatnot. So I think the early era, you hit on a lot of great points, but then the later era of the original rise of Joshi sort of set some other trends. And I thought you were absolutely right, including it, in this timeline. There's no question that it was influential, and more so towards men's wrestling than women's wrestling. And because, you know, that Joshi style never really came to North America. It lent itself to Japanese male wrestling more than it did to the future of women's wrestling, which is a bit odd. And maybe that's because the whole thing collapsed for a few years there and really still hasn't gotten anywhere close to the level it was at during that point in time. I don't know.
The next topic I want to bring up is one that I would love to hear from historians and people who are real into this style of pro wrestling to see if I'm way off the mark on this one. But with Lucha Libre, Lucha Libre obviously has been going for decades and decades and decades, going all the way back to Santo and Blue Demon, all that stuff. So Lucha Libre was not some new thing coming onto the scene in the early 90s when AAA got really big. But the way I kind of view it from what I've seen and from what I've heard and read over the years, the Lucha that was around pre-early 90s was very good, and from what a lot of the stuff I've gone back and watched, a guy like El Satanico, who I've watched a lot of his stuff for Greatest Wrestler Ever, and I've been really impressed with this guy. His brawls are awesome, but there's nothing really in there that I'm like, oh my god, if people saw this at the time that weren't exposed to it, their minds would have been blown. I wouldn't have necessarily thought that. I mean, someone watching NWA in 1986 would probably see a Satanico match and be like, hey, this is really good. God damn, I want to see this guy against Ric Flair or whatnot. But I don't think they would have been like, oh my god, what did my eyes just see? Likewise, that I kind of mentioned the brawling there. Likewise with a lot of the kind of technical stuff. It was really good technical wrestling with a lot of these guys in the 80s. But I don't think it was necessarily completely crazy compared to some of the technical wrestling you'd see from some of the sort of better technical wrestlers that were around in American wrestling or in Japan with people like Jumbo Tsuruta in the 80s. So where I think the AAA boom and the rise of AAA kind of really took people's notice was they were unleashing guys like Rey Mysterio, guys like Psychosis, who had a completely new spin on the Lucha Libre style and were total daredevils and were probably a good bit smaller than a lot of the prime pioneer guys had been. And they were capable of doing a lot more things. And I think the level of innovation that was encouraged by the likes of Antonio Peña and Conan, who obviously had a lot of power during that time, I think it just led to a really crazy, innovative environment for these guys. And I think a lot of people took a lot from what they saw in AAA, your Benoit's and Jericho's and people like that. Yeah, I think that was something that really, when that came along, and when Worlds Collide is a great kind of watermark moment for that style, because when Worlds Collide is something that, to me, in like 2002, when I'm reading my like magazines like Paraslam magazine or watching the Wrestling Channel a couple of years later, I'm hearing about when Worlds Collide, and it's just being spoken of in revered terms. And I think a lot of the reason for that is because so many people hadn't been exposed to the style of wrestling that was seen on that show with the likes of Rey Mysterio, Psychosis, people like that.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about When Worlds Collide and the rise of AAA in the early 90s in general. But going back to Satanico, you're absolutely right. He's a guy who was more hard-hitting. He was a guy who there was just a ferocity to his work and a stiffness and a
believability.
Yes, a real sense of that guy will whip your ass sort of quality to his work, which if people don't know about Satanico, they should go back and watch his stuff, especially if they see Lucha. Look, Lucha critics will tell you it's too light. It's, you know, the selling is weird. It's not believable. Go watch that guy. Okay, you know, he'll change your perception of that. But you're absolutely right, and I think you made a great comparison. A fan of you know, Mid-Atlantic in 1986, they're going to see Satanico, and they're going to say, I want to see him in there at Wahoo. You know what I mean?
I was just going to say, do you know who he's a lot like? Wahoo.
Absolutely. And it's like, you know, and you're absolutely right when you say he wouldn't have been this, you know, this. It wouldn't have been it's not an oh my god moment to watch Satanico. He's just a really good wrestler who anyone can relate to who likes really good wrestling. Whereas in the early 90s, when, you know, Pena did the AAA thing and they rolled it out, that's what really kicked people in the butt. And I got to tell you, the When Worlds Collide pay-per-view is – it might be my favorite wrestling event of all time from a number of different perspectives. I still think we're feeling the ripple effects of that show and that pay-per-view today. I don't think Lucha Underground exists if When Worlds Collide doesn't happen. And if it isn't as successful as it is, as successful as it was. Look at the parallels between When Worlds Collide and the total abomination we saw a couple nights ago with Triple Mania. Okay? Triple A, When Worlds Collide, they were debuting on pay-per-view in 1994, much like Triple A is breaking back into North American pay-per-view in 2015, 20 some odd years later. Both shows were marred by just incredible technical issues, like the likes of which you couldn't even make up.
Really? I never heard that about When Worlds Collide.
The first half hour of When Worlds Collide is practically unwatchable, okay? And now I'm getting to a greater point here. Both shows ended with satellite time remaining, badly timed shows. When Worlds Collide ended about 90 minutes early. There were massive production problems with When Worlds Collide. The wrestlers weren't sure if they were doing best two out of three falls or single fall matches. The timing got all screwed up. They went off the air with 90 minutes left. Triple Mania went off the air with 5 minutes of satellite time to spare, and they missed the biggest angle on the show. Okay? There's tons of parallels here. You could even take it as far as on When Worlds Collide was kind of the introduction of Rey Mysterio Jr., who might have been the most exciting young wrestler in the world at that time, and that was kind of his introduction to the world. And then you flash forward 21 years later, and it's Rey Mysterio Jr. again, returning to AAA, putting them back on the map and drawing big crowds. There's just a million parallels. The difference is the wrestling was so good, and it was so innovative, and it was such a refreshing change of pace to people who had never seen that style of wrestling before, which is the theme of this podcast, that no one even remembers that the show was an absolute disaster from a production standpoint, and that it ended early, and that the video was all screwed up during the opener. And it's like, you know, the same thing would have occurred if Triple Mania the other night would have been a decent show. No one would have cared about the technical issues. But now everybody's hyper-focused on the technical issues because the wrestling was such shit on top of it. So I think that's interesting that you can compare those two shows in that way. No one remembers what a disaster When Worlds Collide was in real time because the show was so good. And, you know, getting back to the theme of this podcast, the wrestling blew people's minds. I know it blew my mind from the opener. Masquerita Sagrada and Octagoncito against Espectrito and... Oh, man, this is why I need to do research before I start. Oh, it was Jarrito Estrada. Jarrito Estrada. Okay, that minis match that opened the show changed my world forever. I was convinced before that minis match was over, and it was only a 7 or 8 minute match. And like I said, you could barely watch it because of the technical issues were so bad. I still have the VHS, and if it wasn't in New Jersey in my mother's attic, I'd probably bust it out once a year to watch it. And I'm gutted. And I'm gutted that they didn't put that show on the network. When they announced the network and said that they were giving us every pay-per-view, that was the first fucking show I looked for. And it's not included. I was so gutted by that. But that opener with the minis blew me away. And at that point, right then and there, I decided I was going to seek out Lucha. And that's exactly what I did. And then I went through a Lucha phase for the next 3 or 4 years. Most of it surrounded by AAA, not EMLL. That was that technical shit that I didn't want to see. You know what I mean? I wanted to see AAA, the big dives, the fresh new stars like Rey Mysterio Jr., Psicosis, later on when Juventud Guerrera, Octagon, all those dudes. You know, it's like Blue Panther is a guy who I really took to, which is strange because he's one of those, you know, he's, you know, completely the antithesis of that style. He was known at that time as one of the best technical wrestlers in the world, but I became
– He was AAA, was he?
In the beginning. He's a guy who jumped back and forth a little bit, but he was on the When's World – he was on the When World Collide show. He was in one of those mid-card matches. I think it was – I think he teamed with Jerry Estrada. La Parca.
Was that the one with Madonna's boyfriend?
No, that was Blue Panther teamed with Jerry Estrada, the full size version. La Parca, the original, like L.A. Park, the good La Parca.
Yeah.
And they faced. I can't believe you're forgetting this. It was the Pegasus Kid, of course, Chris Benoit, Too Cold Scorpio, and do you remember the third man? You're gonna laugh.
Oh. Who was it?
Tito Santana.
It was El Matador, of course.
And he was wearing his El Matador pants.
And he was not really doing too much lucha.
He was not doing too much lucha. So Madonna's boyfriend, Luis Piccoli, he teamed with – that was the Rey Mysterio Jr. match. He teamed with Psicosis and Fuerza Guerrera, and it was Rey Mysterio Jr., Heavy Metal, and for the life of me, I can't remember the third guy.
Who's the guy that was it?
Latin Lover.
Latin Lover. I was going to say the other kind of – because Heavy Metal – was Heavy Metal kind of like – was he doing like a stripper kind of gimmick as well?
Not really.
Or was it just Latin
Lover?
Not
really. He was just kind of doing like a – I don't even know what to call it.
But they were brothers or something, weren't they?
There's
some connection in my mind with those two.
Heavy Metal is part of the Casas family. Yeah, he's a Casas brother. Latin Lover, I don't think, is related to those guys. I could be wrong. I mean, I'm no lucha expert. But, yeah, Heavy Metal is either the brother of Negro Casas, or I don't think he's the son. But, you know, the whole...
It would have to be brother. They would have been right around the same generation. So.
That's true. He's probably only about 10 years younger. So, they're all...
Which is amazing, because, like, where's Heavy Metal now and Negro Casas is still working all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, that guy just – he just defies age. I mean, he's amazing. But, yeah, I mean, that show blew people's doors off, and I'm a testament to that because I'm someone who watched it in real time on old-school pay-per-view and then, you know, seeked out Lucha after that. And that show has had ripple effects 21 years later. I firmly believe Lucha Underground doesn't exist without that show. Obviously, WCW doesn't bring in all of those guys a couple of years later. Obviously – you know, that's the show, you know, Paul Heyman, you know, he booked Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero off the heels of that show. Art Barr died before he had a chance to bring him in. So he kind of brought in Eddie Guerrero to ECW as kind of like, well, I already booked the guy and he's pretty good. So, you know, I'll follow through with it. But his plan was to bring in both of those guys because of how great they were on that show. And of course we know how that worked out for Guerrero. You know, he went to WCW and of course everybody knows the rest. And it's like, you know, the ripple effects of that show are still being felt. So, it's, I know it didn't work out for those guys in WCW. And I know ultimately, you know, AAA has been up and down over the years, and they talked about they really missed the boat. Look, they were – in 1994, AAA was selling out stadiums in the United States, in Los Angeles. The Jake Roberts-Conan feud, was selling out, you know, the L.A. Sports Arena, you know, in 1994. They were doing better house show business than WWF and WCW were at the time. And, you know, AAA talked about expanding into the U.S., and they've been talking about it for 20 years, and they didn't really do it until Lucha Underground. And, they missed the boat. They didn't strike while the iron was hot. And, you know, again, that's a topic for another podcast. But absolutely, the rise of AAA, you nailed it. And then AAA ended up borrowing very heavily from another one of these benchmarks that you have coming up. But I don't want to blow it yet because we have a couple before we get to that one.
Okay, so let's get to our next one. And our next one, I mentioned
Alan,
earlier.
Before you move on to that one,
yes?
Did you think I was going to put over that AAA one so strongly?
I was a little taken aback by it. I wasn't when you said I got a lot to say about when Worlds Collide. I was like, oh, it's Joe Hay from Worlds Collide. Is he going to bury it? Did he rewatch it recently and thought it was absolute steaming pile of dog shit? Because I haven't watched Worlds Collide in a good while. I might have even only watched the whole show from start to finish once. I think I've watched the Eddie tag match a few times, maybe four or five times.
And you gotta be careful with that match because there's a lot of versions floating around that aren't complete. So.
Yeah, which I think I have a DVD somewhere which is like the show as full and complete as it gets. So I think that version is the one I would have watched. But who knows? There might have been a time where it just popped up as a suggested watch on YouTube, and I just watched it, and it might not have been a full version. Because it was kind of not super fresh in my mind as a show, I was like, maybe it doesn't hold up at all. Maybe Joe's going to bury it. But I'm delighted to hear what a what a landmark show was for a young Joe Lanza.
And you're absolutely dead on. If that was a Lucha pay-per-view at the time with Satanico and El Dandy and guys like that who were great workers and great at what they did, it wouldn't have had a fraction of the influence
that
show did.
They just El Dandy, a guy who really well-respected wrestler. He doesn't knock my doors down like he does some people, but I do see how good of a wrestler he was. But to the masses, like in America, in WCW, I know he wasn't given much of a push, but all people remember is that Bret Hart interview. He would be a completely forgotten guy if it weren't for that. It was the guys who were the more colorful, spectacular guys that were the ones that really wowed people. So I think that they were the ones that were the eye catchers. And if you become a hardcore fan because of those eye catchers and you delve deep into it and discover more about the Dandies and the Satanicos and really gain an appreciation for them, great. That's awesome. If you're culturally a part of the culture and you're just, if you're some guy in Mexico who, I don't know, works on a construction site and just a hard-nosed, just salt-of-the-earth Mexican individual, you might love El Dandy. You might see him as representing you and your buddy. But you might like him more than these flashy acrobats. But I mean, when you're exporting this thing to a different audience, they're going to see an El Dandy and be like, what's so good about him? I don't get it. But they're going to see a psychosis with that hair and doing a fucking leg drop off the top rope to the floor. And you'll be like, oh my God, what the fuck? What is this? So, yeah, I think that's where. And like on the whole, I would say El Dandy would be probably a better wrestler than. Well, I wouldn't call him a better wrestler than a Ray or a psychosis, but he'd be a better wrestler than some, maybe more. Hey, Super Callo, there's a guy who catches the eye and did some pretty crazy things when he got his chances, but I would say he's not a patch on the all-around wrestler that El Dandy is, but he might be a little more eye-catching.
From wrestling style, from the influence of the style of the AAA guys to the numerous attempts of people trying to capitalize on look at things like Lucha Libre USA that have come and gone over the years, and you're still feeling it today. And I
there's Lucha Britannia in England that does really well. Just the idea of Lucha, like we have literally around the corner from where I work, there is an extremely successful burrito place, which is totally decked out in Lucha themes, and there's Lucha masks and all. Just the idea of Lucha Libre is something that has really pervaded people's subconsciousness and is in the back of people's mind as this kind of mythical, magical thing that exists, and they think of the masks, and I think without the way when Worlds Collide and the AAA boom really pushed it down people's throats, without that, I don't think it would be as a kind of commonplace in people's minds as it is.
Completely agree. And, you know, I'm so culturally ignorant because, you know, you bring up that you have this burrito shop around the corner, right? And
yeah,
in my mind, and we had this conversation once about pizza in Ireland. And
I don't remember this conversation.
Yeah. So I was confused that you have Italian people in Ireland, like people of Italian, like people of Italian descent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who are Irish people? Like, I'm of Italian descent, right? And I live in the United States. Like, it blows my mind that there are people of Italian descent who live in Ireland. It blows my mind that there are Mexican people of Mexican descent who are Irish, who live in Ireland. To me, to show you what a cultural zilch that I am, I'm an absolute cultural zilch, and how unworld-traveled and what a sheltered dummy that I am. When I picture Ireland, here's what I picture. I picture everyone walking around like Seamus The Cranberry, the Cranberries, and Rovert. That's it. Like, everyone is Irish. Everyone is pale. Everyone has red hair. Everyone is just happy and whimsical like you are, and there's no diversity. And that couldn't be further from the truth, and that's just because I'm a dumb American. It's crazy. I was blown away by the fact that you just said you had a burrito stand around the corner from your house. I'm like, I can't believe this man's ever had a burrito.
Yeah, we're definitely more multicultural and diverse than maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. It's you got all types and all walks of life here, especially around Dublin. But that's a funny story. I live in Dublin, so city where you're gonna kind of naturally get the more kind of mixed. Like if you go to Canada, you're gonna get more of a mix in Toronto in the city, I'd imagine, than in like, I don't know,
Saskatoon,
Calgary, or Saskatoon. Yeah, but where my mom is from in Galway. I don't know if you've heard of Galway before, but it's west of Ireland. It's countryside, kind of what people might think of if they have a real kind of just what you might have thought of as Ireland. And it would not be very multicultural. And in my granny's village where she lives, which is a small village called Gort, they had an influx of Brazilians about 10 years ago because some factory owner brought in loads of Brazilians, and then they all went and brought their families over, and the small town just became overrun with Brazilians. But it was just such a nice, laid back, pleasant town, and all the people were so friendly, and no one was looking to have any issue with this. So they just kind of embraced the fact that all these Brazilians came in, and were like, "Oh, it's lovely." And the priests had to learn how to do mass in Portuguese. So they do a separate mass for the Brazilians in Portuguese, and then the local soccer team became incredible because you had all these Brazilians taking up soccer, playing soccer for like the local Gort soccer team, and they'd be out playing football in the streets. I hadn't been down there in like a year or two before this happened, and I went down and I was like, what the hell's going on here? Where did all these Brazilians come from? It was really, really strange. But I think they might have left after a few years. But there was a massive influx of Brazilians there for a while.
Consider my mind blown. I now want to live long enough to see the day where there is a UFC superstar who is Irish of Brazilian descent. And he's like a Brazilian dude with the Irish Conor McGregor accent, and he's dominating the UFC. I want to live to see that day now. I have to live long enough to see that.
Well, what always blows my mind, and actually I have a girl in work who's like this, but so you mentioned like the having Mexicans who are like Irish and Italians who are like Irish. The Italians have been over here for enough generations that there would be loads of Italians who were born here and whose children were born here. Mexicans, like I'd say the people who run that burrito store, they were born here. They probably only came over in the, I don't think you've got many, but Italians most definitely, ones who've been born here, generations that have been here. But Polish you're starting to see as well. A lot of Polish kids being born here now. But because a lot of Polish people came over in the last, I'd say 10, 12 years ago. But the other one where you're just starting to see a lot of people like my age and younger pop up is Chinese people who were born here and speak with like a Dublin accent. And I always find it hilarious because we've got a lot of Chinese people here, a lot of like students and stuff like that from China. And I would say 95% of them speak like a Chinese person with like Chinese accent, and you wouldn't hear their voice and it without seeing them and be like, oh, there's someone born and bred in Dublin. But you've got a small percentage where that's exactly what it is. They have a complete Dublin accent, and it's really startling. Whenever you walk into the Chinese, you're expecting the Chinese person to have a Chinese accent, and then they come out and speak like Conor McGregor, and you're like, whoa, okay, just adjust here for a minute. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, that would blow me away. I don't know if I can handle that. I might just turn around and walk out the door. That might be too much for me to handle.
The girl I work with, she was born here, she's 100% Irish, but she looks completely Asian. Her parents are Asian, and we always kind of joke with her about that. But yeah, there you go. There's a tangent that we weren't expecting to go on, but an enjoyable one nonetheless.
Listen, that's what Joe Lanza brings to the table. Okay? You invite me on your podcast, it's going to go places that you never thought it was going to go.
But I'm delighted it did. Speaking of diverse and multicultural, Michinoku Pro came about in the mid-90s, and I spoke about Gran Hamada earlier and said we'd come back to this guy. Because this guy, when you talk about influence, and we ran down this on the Hall of Fame show last year, Gran Hamada, in terms of how he set up this style in terms of training and actually creating wrestlers who could do this style, Gran Hamada deserves a ton of credit. A Tiger Mask would have the influence in terms of people seeing him and wanting to do it. Gran Hamada was the guy who gave people the ability to do it. He just bred all these guys in this Lucha Rezu style. And Michinoku Pro was the thing which followed on from Hamada UWF, to give that its credit. But I don't think it was, unless you're fucking Sean Waltman trading tapes in 1991, you didn't know what the UWF was. It was, and I should, for anyone's not aware, that's not to be confused with the UWF shoot style organization, two very different things. But yeah, Michinoku Pro was what came along and what really, I think, took the eye of the tape traders in the mid-90s, because I think you had a lot of people trading, like All Japan and New Japan, but then Michinoku Pro run this big show in Sumo Hall, and that gets a lot of attention, the These Days show. And I think that became a real, you can speak on this, Joe, that became a real sort of hot commodity in the tape trading scene. And it had a really famous 10-man tag on there with Kai and Tai DX and a team of the usual baby faces that would be on that roster, the Tiger Masks and Hamadas and people like that. Personal favorite of mine. Oh, my God, I'm blanking on his name. I feel really bad about this because I wrote a History of Michinoku Pro article. The guy who was dressed as like Peter Pan. Fuck, I can't think of his name. But anyway.
I blank all the time. Don't worry about it.
It's going to come to me in about an hour when we're talking about Ring of Honor. But anyway. Michinoku Pro was like this hybrid of what people were, of what, like the strong style Japanese wrestling was, and what guys like Negro Casas or people over in Mexico were doing on the lucha scenes, kind of blending it all together, hence the name Lucha Rezu. It all came from the fact that you had Gran Hamada as a Japanese wrestler playing his trade in Mexico, coming back to Japan, mixing the styles together. And he just trained people in this way of wrestling, and it really created something different and awesome. It was fast-paced, like we talked about the late 80s women's wrestling being, but it also had all this kind of comedy, for lack of a better term, thrown in, a real kind of lighthearted edge to it. But at the same time, then you'd have the death-defying things that were so great about AAA, with guys like Taka Michinoku doing crazy dives, and other people the same, and super workers like Dick Togo, who were just so, so good and crisp at everything they did. It was just a great crop of wrestlers that really developed a great house style that they were able to, and that was one of the things, was when you could develop a unique house style that you could take and go onto an ECW pay-per-view and just do your usual match, and to you it's nothing special. To maybe your fans back home, it's nothing special. But to a new audience, you see this and you're like, holy fuck, what was that? And this was really the original version of what we talked about earlier, the Dragon Gate guys did in Ring of Honor. This was that 9 years earlier.
okay, first of all, when you talk about Dick Togo, much like Masakatsu motherfucking Funaki, it has to be Dick motherfucking Togo. Okay, that has to be the middle name for that man.
Dick motherfucking Togo.
Because he deserves level of respect.
He deserves that level of respect, and honestly, one of the wrestlers closest to my heart. For I would still say my fondest thing I've ever got to do associated with pro wrestling was sitting down and interviewing that man with his wife sitting beside me for a half an hour. Go watch it on YouTube if you've never watched it. It was one of the highlights of my life, and he was just the best fucking dude to deal with. I love that guy so much.
Yeah, and it's I think something that you hit on, that you touched on a little bit when you were running it down, you stole a lot of my thunder, because what I was going to say about Michinoku Pro is now we're sort of at the point in the evolution where you can see a lot of the things that we've talked about earlier, such as the early 80s New Japan Juniors and the Joshis and the high-flying lucha style sort of are kind of blended into Michinoku Pro, and it clearly drew influence from all of those things. And then some of the things we're going to talk about after Michinoku Pro, such as the rise of the Indies and Dragon Gate, were clearly influenced by Michinoku Pro. So Michinoku Pro is kind of like the epicenter of all of this, where they've kind of drawn influence from what came before them. They influenced what came after. And it's kind of like, if you were going to make a flow chart here, all of these things end up intertwined in some form or fashion, because they all came during the tape trading era, and people were borrowing from each other, seeing what worked in other places, and melding it into their own. And this really was a style that was all its own at this time. And anyone who is sort of – look, I would think that most hardcore Dragon Gate fans have explored Michinoku Pro at some point to some extent. But if you're a new Dragon Gate fan, maybe someone who just jumped on to the Dragon Gate scene over the last year or two, you don't know a ton about Pro history or whatnot, I strongly suggest you go back and watch a lot of this classic Michinoku Pro that Alan was alluding to, because you'll love it. I mean, it's very comparable in style, and to me,
it has the characters.
Yeah, exactly the character work, the comedy that you mentioned, and it's kind of like Gran Hamada's direction, and then there was Ultimo Dragon's direction, but at the end of the day, it's also similar. The Dragon Gate, and then later on, the Dragon Door split, and then all that nonsense. And then on the other side, you had Michinoku Pro. But in reality, I mean, there's no way for you to if you enjoy one of those styles, you enjoy both of them. I mean, it's not possible not to think the world of both of them if you like one or the other.
I think you'll find a few people that are fond of Michinoku Pro who bury Dragon Gate as the worst thing that happened.
You know what? As that thought was tumbling out of my mouth, I thought the same thing. But I mean, it's like, to me, I don't understand how. It doesn't make sense to me.
I think I've always thought that I think there are people who, and I'm not going to knock this, because I may operate subconsciously in the other direction, with always kind of more being more positive about new things versus old things. I think there are people that cling to old things as being better than new things and don't want to give new things the credit and glorify old things. But I think there's a lot of that out there. But
I mean,
I probably go too far in the other direction.
My thing is, if you strip the labels off, if an alien landed on Earth where they had pro wrestling wherever they came from, and you sat this fella down on your couch, and he knew nothing of Michinoku Pro or Dragon Gate, he'd think it was all the same shit. I mean, yeah. I really don't understand where that mindset comes from.
The only difference he'd be able to point out is he'd be like, hey, why in this one are none of the fans sitting on chairs?
I mean, it's all the same shit. I mean, so there could be something to your theory. I don't know. Who knows? But Michinoku Pro, more than a worthy addition. Definitely a style that kicked people in the ass, as we will go back and reference as we move forward.
Who was Joe Lanza's favorite Michinoku Pro guy? Was it Dick Togo?
I mean, how can it
Dick
not
motherfucking
be?
Togo?
It wasn't Wellington Wilkins Jr., for God's sake. I mean,
hey, I saw a match I think my favorite Michinoku Pro show ever was the one with the Sasuke Onita deathmatch in the car park. It's this huge car park where this show takes place, and Sasuke comes down to the ring in a fucking helicopter for this match. It's all, and it's filmed all cinematically, and Lucha Underground fans would love it the way they film it. It's great. It's like you're watching a movie. But, the undercards is some of the weirdest shit ever. But there is a great, like, usual, like, Kantai DX six-man tag that's really good, but there's a match with Wellington Wilkins Jr., but he's under a mask. No, wait. I could be getting this wrong. It was either Wellington Wilkins or it was Wellington Wilkins under a mask. He, like, at one point starts taking liberties with the guys in the ring with, and I think he was Tiger Shark. I think that was his name in this match. I need to look it up, but Tiger Shark was involved, and it was quite the scene. But
Tiger Shark.
Yeah, I gotta have to look that up. But Wellington Wilkins, interesting character in the history of Michinoku Pro. Lenny Lane, another guy. Wasn't Lenny Lane? Was he the guy teamed with Lodi? He had a cup of coffee in Michinoku Pro.
I believe he did. Yeah, and it's funny how it goes full circle because. Ultimo Dragon ended up there anyway. I mean, you know, 20 years later or whatever it was. I mean, you know, primarily working out of there. It's just, it's all the same shit. I mean, it really is. And I don't know. Maybe it's just people sticking to their guns. I don't know what it is. But, Sho Funaki's another guy who, I mean, you know, definitely an underrated guy, especially if all you know of him is the SmackDown run. You know what I mean? Another guy who, by the way, is a complete gentleman, Sho Funaki, because he lives in my neck of the woods now. He's got a dojo in San Antonio, and I've had a couple interactions with him. He translated for me a conversation I had with Takaaki Kidani when he was in for one of those NWA shows, and couldn't have been more patient with me and Kidani trying to have this awful conversation. So Sho Funaki, another guy, complete gentleman. And underrated wrestler as well.
I was completely when he appeared on NXT or whatever he was doing on WWE.com with Kenta, and I was like, he looks no more than 29 years old.
He's another guy who just doesn't age. I mean, he looks exactly the way he looked when he was flying around the ring. He looks incredible. And he occasionally works a match out here, not very often, but he'll occasionally. And let me tell you, his students. Not a ton of them have made a mark on a grander scale yet, but they're all over Texas. They're like cockroaches in Texas, his students that come out of his dojo. And all of them are so technically sound. I mean, you know, so this guy does a great job. I think, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to be seeing a lot of guys who came and girls who came out of his dojo in San Antonio start to make their mark. He really does.
I hadn't heard much about that, but that's really encouraging because, anyone who has the experience and trained by the people that he was, because he didn't just come, like, straight from, like, Hamada. Like, this is a guy who would have had a lot of work in battle arts and training with those guys, and that's where he kind of became so well-known for his. He was known in Michinoku Pro as the technical guy, the ground wizard, and he kind of lost. Even people might have lost sight of that in WWE, where he just kind of was like the comedy guy. But he is a mat machine, and that's really encouraging for me to hear that he's training people. And you got up in Canada, you got Yuki Ishikawa training people for Santino. So yeah, more well seasoned Japanese wrestlers training people is I'm all for it.
And it's the influence we're speaking to on the show. I mean, that we're still going to feel today with him training people who are, you know, 18, 19 years old. So.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So next on our docket is, this one you can definitely talk about, Joe. It's ECW. And ECW in ring, perhaps not in the same way we've talked about these other things, perhaps not super innovative, but I don't think it's like Lucha Underground, where the innovation and the, oh my god, it's different, is more down to just kind of the the cinematic elements, a lot of the way they're filming it and the production with ECW, all that was big. I think that the main thing with ECW was just the attitude, and the attitude that the in-ring product was presented with. It was more hardcore, it was more edgy, it was more eye-catching and made you take notice a lot more than what was kind of the more polished, demure product that you'd have with WF and WCW at the time. It's obviously ground. It's been well covered on a million podcasts, but maybe just briefly talk about, like, for you, when you're a wrestling fan in 1994 and you're watching WF, WCW, what are your initial thoughts and what was your initial introduction to ECW? I kind of want to get more of your personal experience rather than kind of ECW, what it was, because that's been covered a million times.
Okay, so I found it. I grew up in New Jersey, so I found it in the middle of the night on the MSG network when they were buying time at 2 in the morning on late Friday nights or whatever it was. And I had a neighbor who was a wrestling nut just like I was. And we were just, you know, getting into the tape trading scene and starting to read the newsletters, you know, only, you know, probably 92, 93-ish somewhere in that neighborhood. And we were aware of its existence, and we found it. Auntie, I'll never forget the first time I called his house. We were, you know, probably juniors in high school at the time. I didn't care about waking up his family. I had to wake this guy up and let him know what was on. And, you know, from then on, it was an obsession. And we had to, and from the first episode that we saw, we had to find a way to get down to that ECW arena. And that's exactly what we did. You know, I stole the keys of my mother's car. We hopped.
You did not, did you?
We hopped in the car, and this was before GPS. This was before MapQuest. This was like,
you just had to get to the corner of Swanson and Rittner. You'd find it.
You know what? That's more true than you'll ever know, because all we did is we hopped on the highway and went south. Okay? And we followed the signs to Philadelphia. We get to Philly. And then from there, it's just old school, which you never see anymore because of technology, stopping at gas stations at every corner. Hey, how do we get to South Philly? Okay. So then we get to South Philly. All right. And then we pull over, and I'll never forget, we asked this dude – this scary looking dude in like the meatiest part of South Philly.
Visualizing all this, it's amazing.
And we pull over and we're like, I roll down the window and I'm like, excuse me, sir, we're looking for the corner of Swanson and Rittner. And the guy looks into the car and he takes a peek around. We're not sure if he's a drug dealer. You know what I mean? And he says to us, I'll never forget the look on his face. It turned into a big smile. He goes, brother, you're at the corner of Swanson and Rittner. And he turned around and he pointed with his finger, and there it was. And just like anybody who goes there for the first time, the reason we didn't know we were there is because it's just this innocuous building on the corner of these two streets. It's at the time, you know, before they remodel. Even now, if you go there, it may be remodeled on the inside, but on the outside, it's just this innocuous looking warehouse with a steel door pulled down in the front. You know, it's at the very far reaches of the end of South Philly with a railroad track across the street where you saw all of those vignettes with Public Enemy and everybody else. They probably filmed them right on those railroad tracks. Okay. Not the best part of town. And you're like, that's it? This is what we've been watching on TV for the last month? That's the building? And so we parked, we went inside, and, you know, for me personally, it you know, as far as being a wrestling fan, you know, and anybody else, it changed me forever. And it's just, I'll never forget those shows. It was every third Saturday after that. We went every single time, and we didn't miss a show for, like, the next 3 years. And it was right in that great era, too, probably from the end of 94 until the beginning of, right before Barely Legal. You know, that time where everything was just clicking, because after Barely Legal, it all changed. It was just different after that. And before 1995, it was different. It was still Eastern Championship Wrestling. It had a whole completely different vibe. But from 95 till about mid 97, you know, that's, I think, what people think of as really, that was ECW. And that's what, and I was fortunate enough to be in the building and to feel, and it was such a great atmosphere. Everybody always sat in the same seats, And it's like, it was just such a, like, we always sat, sort of like if we were facing the ring, the crow's nest was to our left and the exit was to our right. And we were right across the way from the straw hat guy and the sign guy. And the Cato Kalin guy was always about three rows in front of us. And the crow's nest was to the left. And, Dave Scherer and all those guys were always sitting off to the right. And it was like, you know, you would always have the same people sitting next to you, and it was just an incredible atmosphere for a 19-year-old red-blooded American male. I mean, they were just hitting me on every chord, and that's who Paul Heyman was playing to. And it's something that, you know, I've been to a million Ring of Honor shows during the heart of Ring of Honor. I've been to WWE shows in Madison Square Garden. Nothing for me will ever top the atmosphere and the feelings that I had when I was at those ECW arena shows. And, you know, so that's my little story. You know, so I kind of lived it as a fan, you know, so, and in terms of what we're talking about here, you know, Heyman was always, you know, the big theme here is all of these revolutions we're talking about, we're always ahead of the curve. And Paul Heyman's a guy who always tried to stay ahead of the curve. He's always a guy who was looking at what's next. Not what's now, but what's next. And yeah, they borrowed heavily from FMW and a lot of the garbage wrestling in Japan, but they also, Heyman also borrowed heavily from a lot of the things we already talked about. He brought in those AAA luchadors. He brought in the Michinoku Pro guys. So he tried to stay ahead of even the tape traders at the time and tried to bring in those new styles. He brought in Eddie Guerrero. He brought in Chris Benoit, but we know all about that. But and then, of course, moving forward from ECW, of course, they had an enormous influence in everything that came after. I mean, you could argue that they were the prime influence of the Attitude Era, which changed everything. And but yeah, we, you know, I guess you don't want to make this an ECW history hour, but yeah, so there you go. I don't know if I gave you what you wanted to hear.
Oh, you certainly did. And for me, it was when I was watching Entrenched in WWF in the mid-90s, I'd see these glimpses of ECW come up when they came in and did their stuff on Raw that time that the WF guys were on a tour of Europe or something. I forget what the exact details were, but they had to fill up the hour Raw with ECW guys. And I remember I would have been watching Livewire, whatever Todd Pettengill hosted show it was on the Saturday morning, and I was seeing the clips of it, and I'm like, what is this? It's just very confusing, and it went away, and I didn't really get to think about it again. Then I started getting Parastar Magazine. They were covering ECW to the same degree as they would cover WF WCW, and it just, from the pictures and from what I was reading, it sounded so crazy to me, and I was like, Jesus, it really did take my interest, but it just seemed like it wasn't something that I could easily get a hold of. I didn't understand or realize that there was a tape trading at that point in like 97, 98. But then once I did kind of become aware of tape trading, also coincided with the time where a lot of the shops here started stocking ECW DVDs. And I started getting my first. I remember vividly, I was in a toy store where they stocked a lot of like PlayStation games and wrestling videos. And I was walking past the aisle where they usually would have this set up. And they had a little TV hooked up. It was probably one of those old school TVs that had the video cassette part at the bottom of the TV, like the all-in-one unit.
Yeah.
And you remember those, yeah?
Yeah.
So, okay, so I was just reading in Daniel Bryan's book today about how when he packed up his car to go to Texas, he had one of those in his car with all his wrestling tapes, which made me just love him. But I digress. They had one of these things set up, and it was they had all these ECW, the shelf of ECW tapes. And I was like, oh, my God. And I look up, and I see on the TV they're playing one of these ECW tapes. And I was just looking, I was like, wait, this just looks so much different. Just the actual look of it, I was like, it's so much different than WF. It looked really rinky-dink compared to the glamorous WF I was used to, which is ironic because WF, throughout the 90s, I was just watching that Click documentary recently, and like they were showing some of the arenas they used to tape Raw in. Like, Jesus, Ring of Honor, every building they run nowadays is bigger than that. And that. But whatever way they just presented WWF, it just looked a lot more glamorous than the way ECW was here. I'm sure that was intentional with the way as they've talked about how the ECW production was. But so yeah, it was. It took me a second to get over that, and then I had to get myself some tapes. So I get myself some tapes, and it's everything I read about. It's the putting people through tables. It's the cursing, which I'm a 13, 14-year-old. Like, this and South Park is just, like, all I need in my life at this point. Like, just people cursing when they shouldn't be – when, like, you're used to watching things where that stuff's not allowed, and you got people doing moves they shouldn't be doing, and like women are getting beat up. Everything you'd want as a 13-year-old. No, it was just, it so pushed the envelope and the attitude that the guys wrestled with. It was, it seemed just way edgier to me. And it was, I went through that huge ECW phase that I think everyone went through, that you kind of come out the other end of it being like kind of a bit desensitized to it. I think at least that's kind of how I felt I was. I think by the time I watched my, I don't know, 15th ECW VHS, the luster had worn off just a little bit. But yeah, it's certainly the first time you see it when you're used to what was going on and what you're being used to seeing. That first ECW is, you're not going to forget it. And I'll always remember my first one was that Hardcore Heaven 97. I just remembered like Joey Styles doing the intro at the start of the show. And I think Bubba Ray Dudley came out. And I think that was the show that the whole show followed the Dudleys. They went around putting hits on people for Joel Gertner because he got blinded by it. I can't remember. I'm getting a little confused. But it was something.
See, so you get it because you were there. And the thing is, I totally understand people who weren't there in real time, or – I mean, we've got people writing for our site who weren't even born when I was going to these shows, which is terrifying to me. But I totally get that those people don't get it when they put on their little WWE Network and they put on their old ECW hardcore TVs, which it wasn't even called that at the time. And they watch it and they go, this is it. This is the big, bad, revolutionary ECW. But it was something that I know people hate the phrase. I hate the phrase, but you really had to be there. And if you were there, you completely understand why Alan included it on this list. It was a no-brainer for something. If you want to talk about something that slapped people across the mouth and made them take notice, it was without a doubt ECW at that time. And, definitely has a soft spot for me, but definitely earned its place in this list as well.
Yeah, I think if I was in America at the time, I would have been all in on it. Because, like, if I had got the, like, so if I was, like, 10 when it was happening, I was, like, 13, 14 when I actually kind of got a hold of it. But when it was happening, I was 10. And if 10-year-old me saw this, like, I think I would have been like the Briscoes, like just the kids, because I don't know how many kids did you see at those shows. There was probably a pocket here and there. And,
believe it or like, not, I'll tell you, there were some kids at those shows. In fact,
I would have been one of those kids, I think.
Yeah, you know, I used to bring my little brother occasionally, and he's about 5 or 6 years younger than me, so he would have been about your age, I guess, then, right? So that would have put him at about
85. I was born.
Yeah, he was 82, so he's a little older than you. So, you know, he would have been maybe about 12 or 13 or whatever it was, and I would bring him to shows. And there was this one group of, like, probably 12 to 14-year-olds who would always be in our section. Like I said, it was always the same people at these shows, and we'd always sit in the same seats. So you never saw, like, 7 or 8 year. It never got that young, but you definitely saw there was a decent contingent of, 12 to 14, that sort of age range. So that you did see. I'll tell you, The television show, though, we would record that on VHS, and the entire neighborhood, for the entire week until the next one aired, we would watch the shit out of that show. Every second of it, from the intro with the Nine Inch Nails opening that bled into the Rob Zombie opening. I don't know if you remember that for the hardcore TV. They changed, you know, they don't use the licensed music on the network anymore, but it would be the beginning of the Nine Inch Nails song, and then it would turn into Thunder Kiss by White Zombie. And, you know, that would be the opening to the show. And from the opening through the closing of that show, we would eat every second of that show up. And we would watch it every day after school until the next Friday when the next one came out, and then we would repeat the process and do it all over again. And the most popular episode in our neighborhood was when it was Raven and Stevie Richards against the Pit Bulls in a double dog collar match, which involved copious use of tables. And
I just remembered that being when I used to read reviews. I used to go online like on the 411 Mania and places like that, and I'd print out reviews on paper. I'd print out reviews of like old ECW shows. Like this would have been, I don't know, 2001, 2002. I'd print out all these reviews of these shows from people like Scott Keith. And I remember Scott Keith giving that match 5 stars and talking about it being like one of the greatest matches. And I was like, I need to see this match. And then when my video store at a toy shop, or actually I think it was HMV, it was like when HMV got in those extra old, because like the initial ECW tapes that kind of hit in the shops here were like I'd say Hardcore Heaven 97 was probably the earliest one they had. And maybe Barely Legal. But when they started getting all those older ones, I just had to find the one with the dog collar match, because that was the one that Scott Keith gave 5 stars to.
And I'll tell you, that's one of the very few matches that I wish I never watched again 20 years later. I mean, you know, even with the fondest...
Talk about Dog and Pony
match,
Show.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you want to talk about just crushing memories. I mean, look, it doesn't hold up. But, I mean, at the time... And you know my taste now. I'm a guy who can't stand brawls. And, you know, at the time, though, for whatever... That promotion, it just spoke to me. And it spoke to everybody else in my age range who was a wrestling fan at that time. You know, Shane Douglas beating Ron Simmons with his boot was another episode I remember. Doink getting chokeslammed by 911. It just goes on and on. You know, the Public Enemy stuff, the gangsters. You know, I got shouted down by New Jack at an ECW show. I mean, I'll never forget that. I mean, it's just, I was screaming like an idiot, you know, 19-year-old Mark, and he turned around right to me and told me to shut the fuck up, and it popped the crowd. And, you know, I'll never forget. I was the most embarrassed person in that building, and I'll never forget
that. New Jack
was
coming on to my girlfriend in Miami. There's a New Jack story for you.
Sweet. We're connected through New Jack.
I'm on one side of the room, talking to Pac, and I leave my girlfriend on the other side of the room, and I notice in the corner of my eye, New Jack is over my girlfriend. I'm like, okay, Pac, time to just end this conversation here now. I gotta go save my girlfriend from this crazy man.
What a bizarre story. Pac and New Jack in the same room. New Jack's trying to take your girlfriend back to the hotel room. You're chatting it up with Pac. You know, I'm almost waiting for like Razor Ramon to walk through. I mean, how did all these people?
He was probably there. It was after the Dragon Gate USA show at the WrestleMania weekend in Miami. So you had all the legends there as well. I'll always remember one of the greatest things one of the greatest interactions I've ever had with a wrestler. Do you remember when Sabu had his cup of coffee with DGUSA?
Yes.
And he feuded with like Sammy Callahan and whoever else was involved in that.
Was Sabu and Sammy Callahan who had the quote-unquote final match of the ECW arena.
This is true.
I don't know if it was an Evolve. I think it was an Evolve show, actually.
It was Evolve. It was the Evolve for Gargano. Fucked up his back.
Yes. The big angle to close the arena was Sammy Callahan standing over the dead body of Sabu after dispatching multiple other ECW legends such as JT Smith. Big favorite of mine, that was a complete dud of an angle. And thank God that was not the final event ever held in the arena. But go ahead.
So I think it was Sabu and Sammy Callahan on this DGUSA show in Miami, and Sid was out watching this match from, like, kind of, I don't know, the back wall. The Joe Lanza position, actually.
Joe Lanza position, the back wall. How do you get into rooms with these random people? This is amazing, but go ahead.
It's just that they were all at the, staying in this hotel for where this show was happening. And so Sid is watching along. There's other old wrestlers scattered around. But Sid was watching, and at one point, Sid is seen marking out during this match, and he is like starts cheerleading, and he moves closer and closer towards the ring, and he's really getting involved in this. And it's like, wow, Sid's really really into this stuff. And that I saw him out again later when like Tozawa was wrestling Mochizuki, and he seemed to be real perked up about that as well. And I was like, god damn, Sid Dragon Gate fan. So after the show, when like there's all this kind of congregating and people are talking, great conversation with Kevin Sullivan as well at this point at the bar. me, Sarah, and Kevin Sullivan have a full-blown conversation with Kevin Sullivan, and as we're walking away, the conversation started with he goes to us hearing us like, "You folks from Ireland? I was just in Donegal with my wife." And we have this big conversation. I start talking to those with Doug Furness and all this. And we're walking away, and Sarah's like, "Who is that?" And I go, "That's Kevin Sullivan." She goes, "The guy that they say killed Benoit?"
Oh, God.
Like, yeah, the very guy. But she had no idea it was him. She was shocked. But so there's all this kind of congregating happening. And I see Sid walking out to get some air. And I'm walking by him. I'm like, "Hey, Sid, I see you really love the show. You really like the Japanese guys?" I'm all perked up, like waiting to have Sid put over my Dragon Gate guys, and I gotta go off and tell everyone Sid's a massive Dragon Gate fan. And then he just kind of shrugged his shoulders and, "Nah, I didn't really like that shit. They're doing too much. They're nah, they don't know how to work." I was like, "Oh, you seem like you're really into it." I was like, "No, it's my Sabu's my buddy. I wanted to get people into his match, and I wanted to kind of get people going for his match. He's a good pal of mine." And it's like, all right,
so Sid always the worker.
Yeah, Sid broke my heart.
Yeah, well, he broke Rich's heart too. I'm sure you've heard that story on Voices.
No,
I will save that. I mean, it's not, believe me, it doesn't involve Kevin Sullivan, Doug Furness, and New Jack trying to take your girlfriend back to the hotel room. So I don't want to set you up.
Oh, and Pinky Sanchez, your favorite Pinky Sanchez, asked us if we had any weed. I don't know why he was asking us with New Jack just like right there also.
You would think that New Jack would be the go-to guy for a question like that, because if New Jack didn't have the weed, he probably knows the guy who does. So I'm surprised he came to you instead. Does it offend you that he chose you, or like, if you have two choices in a room, right, and one of them is New Jack and one of them is you, and the person asks you for the drugs, should you be offended by that?
I don't know. I don't think he was altogether with it. He was pretty much passed out on the couch where we're all kind of sitting chatting, and he's like, "Anyone got it?" Or was he asking for weed, or was he asking us to buy him drinks? I can't remember. It was one or the other, and it was maybe it was both, and he just, yeah, he wanted. So I think, like, our Austrian friend Wolfgang, who's appeared on this show once before, it was the first night we met him too, a lovely fellow with great stories about his wrestling fandom, but he, full of just energy and joy for life, I think he just took Pinky by the shoulder and was like, "Come on, young man," and he took him to the bar and got him a drink.
Well, if you're listening to this show and you're filling out your DKP bingo card and you had Wellington Wilkins Jr., Kevin Sullivan, Pinky Sanchez.
Wellington Wilkins Jr., by the way, Shark Machine. And he wrestled the guy who, on that show in the car park, he wrestled the other guy whose name I was trying to remember, Masato Yakushiji.
That sounds like something Rich would book on a year-end show when he runs out of guys to draft. So,
the car park show. Yoshihiko against Ryuji Ito or whatever that match was. Yeah,
I believe that's what it was.
Oh, Joe, we got a couple more little topics to get into here. So let's hit the next one. 2002, ECW is gone, WCW is gone. The US Indies throughout the 90s was never really much of a thing. You had your Don Montoya's and your who is the guy that wasn't Don Montoya or Mike Quackenbush? Am I thinking of
Reckless Youth?
Reckless Youth, yeah.
How are we on the same page with that? Of all of the, like, I knew exactly who you were talking about, and I have no clue how. But, like, when you bring up Don Montoya and Mike Quackenbush, it's almost like naturally the person that pops into your head is
Black T-Shirt Squad.
Black T-Shirt Squad, and then you, then there's Ace Darling, and of course it's
Devin Storm.
And there you go. If you bring up Ace Darling, of course you have to bring up Devin Storm next because they wrestled each other roughly 10,000 times in New Jersey and Delaware and between those.
Billy Kidman, I think, before he became in Raven's Flock and grew out the hair, and he was one of those guys too.
And you know, Ace Darling wore a rug all those years. You know that, right?
He wore a rug? Did he really?
Is this like a Silver Ant level of breaking kayfabe that I just did on your show now? Did I just get you in trouble?
Yeah, you might have got yourself in trouble with this one. You might have Ace Darling coming looking for you.
I might. I very well could. I don't know where he is these days. But but yeah, so I mean, yeah, that... yeah, that.
It wasn't really a big thing. Those guys were known amongst hardcores, I guess, in like PWI. I think Quackenbush had like a column or something like that.
Cheetah Kid!
Was Cheetah Kid Ted Petty?
Yes.
Ah.
Cheetah Kid was a thing on the East Coast Mask Knockoff Act. And then, of course, everything changed in the aforementioned ECW with the Rocko Rock Roll. So, yeah, Cheetah Kid was amongst that crew. But, yeah, you know, definitely. Indie wrestling was far different. I'll let you make the point. Go ahead.
So, WCW and ECW close. And I don't know if people looked to the indies at that point, or did the indies just make people look at them? Because the indies got a huge kick in the pants at this point. I guess there was a lot of talent that kind of came onto the scene. A lot of young talent were coming up, inspired by the likes of ECW, who would have probably been the next generation of ECW talent. And they needed a place to hone their craft, and really the... there was a few different groups around that really gave people a chance, your JPWs, your CZWs, IWA Mid-South, of course. But it was all about Ring of Honor, let's be honest, especially when you talk about on an international level. Ring of Honor got huge popularity over here in Europe as well as in America. And it was a big deal. Like when I think of going to the first Ring of Honor show in Liverpool in 2006, that was like a huge thing. And these, you could tell these are all fans that have been really invested in this thing for a few years at this point, and they really saw it as a hot promotion. Ring of Honor was really the big one, and the guys that Ring of Honor were really showcasing at the start, your Danielson, your Daniels, your Low-Key, AJ Styles to an extent, these guys were bringing elements of the Japanese style of wrestling, which had been seen to an extent by tape traders and whatnot, but I don't think people had seen young U.S. wrestlers really take that style to the level these guys took it to and have matches, because you had the likes of Benoit. Have like Benoit and Eddie would come on to an episode of Nitro, and they'd have like a really good, hard-hitting 9-minute match with a brutal powerbomb and a brutal German suplex, and people are like, whoa, that's crazy. But it's a whole another kettle of fish when you've got Low-Key and Bryan Danielson going out there for 30 minutes and having an all-Japan, New Japan-style main event match in a little recreational center in Philly. And having it get the reactions it was getting and seeing how passionate the fans were for it, this was something that the buzz that was going around early Ring of Honor, and it was the same thing for me when I watched that as when I got my first ECW. When I first saw it, I was like, whoa, this looks kind of rinky-dink. But then you quickly get by that when you see just how amazing the wrestling is. And they really pushed the envelope as far as just having these epic matches and near falls and innovative moves and hard hitting, all of it, everything these guys could pull together in the aim of doing great pro wrestling, they were not afraid to try anything and do anything, and that it really made for something special in those early days.
I think with ECW, the rough look sort of was part of the charm. And, when they got the deal with TNN or whatever it was, TNN, right? Is that who they had the deal with?
TNN.
My concern was it's going to the look of the show is going to be too clean now. And I wondered if that was going to hurt the experience for people who had never seen it before. With Ring of Honor, I don't think it was intentional, but like it was with ECW. It didn't really add to the charm of Ring of Honor. But it's like you say, it did not fucking matter, because the wrestling in Ring of Honor at that time was so far above and beyond what we were seeing ever, because it was new and it was different, and that's been the theme of everything here. It was new and it was different, and it has proven to be highly influential as we move, a dozen years forward or, into the future. We don't have to tell the people listening to this. You just look at the top of the, you go watch wrestling on a Monday night, and you could see the Ring of Honor influence. The wrestling, it just kicked you in the mouth, and it changed everything. And all the indies changed from that point forward. All of your major indies, emulated Ring of Honor to some extent from that point forward. A lot of them were using a lot of the same talent, and. And Ring of Honor is something else that I lived in the right place at the right time, that I was also able to experience in real time at the shows. I never missed a Ring of Honor show when they came through New Jersey, New York City, or Philadelphia. And
you were a Murphy Wreck regular?
There was the Armory, and then they ran the ECW Arena a few times. They ran a few different buildings in Philadelphia. In New Jersey, it was Edison, New Jersey, at the Inman Inman Sports and Rec Center, and then in New York.
Edison was okay, but Long Island was the shit one. I think it was a building that Mick Foley got them the hookup with, and it was always the deadest crowd. I used to hate the Long Island shows. I remember there was a show with Christian called How I Roll that was just like the blandest, most boring Ring of Honor show
and,
ever.
And Christian just didn't get it. He didn't understand. He didn't work that match the way he should have worked it. And I like Christian, but to Christian, that was just an indie shot. He didn't understand. I never went out to Long Island. I went to, obviously Hammerstein a million times, whether it was the Grand Ballroom or the Hammerstein Ballroom, whatever they ran, depending on, who they had in, they would run the bigger room or the smaller room when they went to New York City. Edison, that was right in my neck of the woods, right where I grew up, went to all those shows. Gabe Sapolsky actually hated the Edison building because they didn't have their own bathroom. They had to share the bathroom with the fans. That was strike number one. And the configuration of the building was just as such where he always complains about that building. He never liked it, and he always tried to find ways out of it. But they ran the Rahway building once, and that was a disaster. So they were always stuck in Edison. But anyway.
What show was in Rahway?
Rahway was either Rahway or Union was the disastrous Dragon Soldier B show.
Oh, yeah.
And
there was a really good Brian Kendrick, James Gibson match, I think, on that.
Yeah.
And James Gibson, Roderick Strong.
But, I mean, that's generally regarded as, because New Japan poking their nose in, Kendo Koshin being terrible, just generally regarded as, one of the worst shows in Ring of Honor. But it's so bad that, everyone has to go out of their way to see it bad. You know what I mean?
It's Kendo Koshin trolling the Ring of Honor fan base.
Yes.
Of, 1,000 people just to his heart's content.
Which was in a rainstorm, the likes of which New Jersey hadn't seen in years, and people got there late, people were grumpy to begin with, and then he just he just shit on those fans. And it's like, the whole Dragon Soul, it's become a thing people look back at and laugh. Now, people were incensed at the time.
Oh, I remember. So, yeah, I was online and everything in those days. And I remember the fury. I was like, what the hell? I wasn't familiar with who Kendo Koshin was at that time. And then when I started to see, when I started to become more of a Japanese wrestling fan, and whenever he popped up in anything, I was like, oh, that motherfucker.
Yes. Dragon Soldier B, which, where was Dragon Soldier A? What was going on with that? But it's like, could you imagine Ring of Honor in the age of Twitter, especially on the night of that show. I mean, those are the kind of things I think about. Because if you remember back during Ring of Honor, it's like people would constantly refresh their computers on the Ring of Honor boards to get the results when there was a show. You know what I mean? It's like Twitter has replaced that whole dynamic now. There was a different kind of charm back then to staying up, you know, to all hours waiting for Ring of Honor results. Especially for you being in Europe. I mean, that, you know, you know, you stand up till 5-6 o'clock in the morning to, you know, to see if Danielson beat Delirious.
I remember doing that for the Joe Aries title change, which is a Christmas, and I remember staying up and waiting to see what the result was going to be, and yeah, that was quite the deal when Aries won that one.
I think, you know, I was kind of a little – I jumped on board a little late. I mean, I always had one eye on Ring of Honor, and I obviously always enjoyed it, but – the show that really kicked me into, okay, I'm all in on this promotion, was Final Battle 05 with the Kenta Loki match, which to me is still one of the best matches I've ever seen. And also on that show was Mara Fuji versus Bryan Danielson, which was
excellent match. Super underrated because of the Kenta Loki match.
You're in my head again, Alan. Exactly why that match is underrated. And, you know, the Kenta Loki match was so good that, you know, my non-wrestling fan brothers once walked into a room while I was watching that match and were so enthralled by it that they instantly became interested in both of those guys and seeked out their matches. And they don't even like wrestling. That's how good that match was. So, you know, Ring of Honor, I mean, you know, it's nothing like it was, you know, when it was a thing, you know, 10 years ago today. But clearly had to be included on this list, and you know, its influence. You know, WWE, it's really a shame that it took them so long to jump on board, because there was kind of that lost generation of Ring of Honor guys who never got their fair shake, and they would have had they been, you know, a half a dozen years younger. And the first guy that jumps to mind is Austin Aries. I mean, Austin Aries is a guy who just, you know, he just came a little too soon, and his career took him to you know, places that it just didn't work out for a guy like that. Christopher Daniels is another one.
Do you know, I'll give you an example, and I honestly never thought of this guy in this frame of mind until now, but I think he would have been so great for WWE, because he would have just shook things up, and he would have been a guy who when I think about WWE, if I throw everything out there on the ground and look at it all, my biggest thing that bothers me about WWE is how overly polished and pre-produced, and it just doesn't have an edgy what's going to happen next feel really ever for the last 10 years. A guy who I would have loved
Cena,
to...
The Cena era is what you're referring to.
Yeah.
It's wrestling
guy who
in
I
primary colors is what you're getting at. There's no... Yeah. It's just red and blue.
A guy I would have loved to seen thrown in there and given a chance to really be himself, and it would never happen, but I mean, I would have loved to see Homicide in WWE and let him be Homicide. I just think that could have worked so well, and he's shot now. He could never, you could maybe bring Homicide on for an NXT loop of house shows, as you say, so often put some butts in those 3,000 seat arenas in the Northeast. Homicide would probably work for that, but I mean, maybe even use him in like a Liger role on a live special in the way they're using Liger against Tyler Breeze. But I would have loved to have seen Homicide 10 years ago. That Homicide getting a shot now in WWE, it would be, I think he'd just do wonders.
You know, it's funny because a lot of these benchmarks that we're talking about, a lot of people are out there listening, and they think a lot of these are negative overall to wrestling. And Ring of Honor being one of them, a lot of people think the Ring of Honor influence was negative. Guys working too fast, guys doing too many moves, guys copying Japan, you know, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, you know, I think we should recognize that too, that, you know, a lot of these things, you know, there are some fans who don't, we see most of these benchmarks as positive kicks in the ass that wrestling needed at the time. I think we would both agree with that. Right down the list, everything that we've mentioned so far.
I think wrestling always needs it. I think I would love And I'm going to get to what I think the what we have in lieu of. When I say we don't have this thing coming along now, I think there's other advantages we have in the current climate, which I'll get to in a minute. But even still, I think wrestling's crying out for something to happen now that is like, oh my God. And in 5 years, it will be even more so. So I think you can always have something like that, and it would be welcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... It's just progression, man. And things are constantly evolving. And I know people get mad at me when I say that, where I say wrestling is always progressing. Some people would argue that it's regressed in a lot of ways. I think that's silly. I think overall wrestling is never better, has never been better than it is right now. In terms of great matches happening all over the world, the advancement of the art and everything else. Whether you disagree with the term progressing or not, It's always going to constantly evolve and change, and that's never going to stop. Even if what we talked about 2 hours ago, where athletically it hits a wall, it's still going to evolve in other ways. And I think you're absolutely right. I don't think anything has happened since that Dragon Gate six-man in Chicago. I think that was the last kick in the ass that wrestling had. And I do think that we're overdue for one. I don't know what it is. I do know what it's not. I do not think it's this new grappling style that we've seen come into favor. I really don't, because I don't think that that style.
It's an acquired taste. I like a lot of that. It's very acquired taste. I like a lot of that stuff. It's awesome live. When I've seen some of the stuff I saw over WrestleMania weekend with Thatcher and that Thatcher Tommy End match live, that was incredible, and I was so entranced in what they were doing live. It's so awesome. Watching on DVD or watching on iPay-per-view, easy to lose focus. And I think in this generation, whereas as you've talked about in your show, when people's Twitter is just a second, or just a reach away for people, and they have their phones in their hands, and it's easy to get distracted. It's not the ideal style at all to. Even if it had a broader appeal, which I don't think it does, it's not the ideal style to really, at the level we're talking about. Hey, at Gabe's level of Evolve, I think it's definitely worth trying. And I remember talking to Gabe in New Orleans a year ago, and when this was kind of just – and he had had I think he had had there was some match he'd had on one of those shows. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. And I was like, there's enough good guys out there that this is worth kind of exploring. And I think at that level, and it's working well for Evolve. I think Evolve with Thatcher as champion, and I know you disagree on that, Joe, but
no, actually,
with Thatcher
I'll tell
as champion,
you, let me jump in real quick. I don't. I think it definitely freshened up Evolve, and it gave them that fresh coat of paint that they needed, regardless of whether I'm into it. I could be fair about it. Evolve
but on
had gotten
on a mass,
completely stale, and you're absolutely right. It totally gave them a fresh coat of paint.
Yeah, but on a broader level, to get more kind of to do what ECW did, or to do what Triple Mania did, or to do what early Ring of Honor did, and to grab that many people, it's not the type of thing that would do it. So we are overdue. It's not going to be that. What it is going to be, I really don't know.
It's not going to be intergender for a million different reasons. I mean, it's just not.
You know, the whole intergender being a thing and a thing that people debate over, I never really, like, when Candice LeRae was, like, I didn't even, like, when she wrestled, I didn't even think twice about it. It was just, like, I feel like, is that a new thing? I kind of always thought there was, like, some intergender matches popping up. Like, Chikara would, like, Sarah Del Rey was wrestling, like, Claudio, like, 7-8 years ago on a Chikara show. I remember it's not something that ever really struck me as a real great thing or a real bad thing. It's just something that happens every now and then. And yeah, I don't see it as a particularly thing, discussion worthy thing.
It really isn't.
I guess it is for people.
Well, you know what? That discussion is right about it. It's 13th or 14th minute. The clock is ticking. The 15 minutes of intergender being a hot topic are just about up. I mean, I think, you know, there's...
It just seems really forced that people are making it a hot topic issue.
No question about it. So, but I'm just trying to look for things that are happening on the scene now that are a little different, that are talked about. And I just don't see – whatever it is, that next thing, we aren't even seeing the beginnings of it yet. I don't
– Yeah.
So
– it's going to have to come from – what's the baseball term? Come from
what base?
Left field? Is that it?
Yes. You successfully used an American baseball term. Yes. It's got to come from – like all of these things did that we've talked about today. I mean, they all came around from left field. So,
well, let's just touch briefly on the last one and bring this full circle. Dragon Gate coming into Ring of Honor in 2006. When this happened, had you had much exposure to Shima and the Dragon Gate guys? I know Shima and Shingo did one Dragon Gate show in late 2005, or one Ring of Honor show in late 2005, but honestly, that's not even worth getting into too much discussion on. It was when the whole group came over en masse, WrestleMania weekend in Chicago, and there was a Detroit show just before that, and they just tore the house down repeatedly with the famous six-man tag being the showpiece. How much Dragon Gate had you seen to this point? Was this something that when these guys were coming in, you were like, hey, I know what these guys are going to do. These guys are going to knock people's socks off. Or were you one of the people that were at the start, sort of like, okay, what's this? And then by the end, like, oh my God.
I knew enough. I had seen enough to know who they were and to not be completely blown out of my shoes. But I will say that, you know, the thing about that match, and I know where you're going with this, it was a great match, and it was a great match at the right time in the right place. And for all those reasons, that's why I think, you know, to me, it's a 5-star match. And for me, the match of that, the best match of that year, and the match I voted match of the year. With that said, I'm well aware that there's a ton of people who don't even think it was the best Dragon Gate match that year. But the fact of the matter is, when you're talking about, you know, a match of the year type match, or you know, it was such a groundbreaking and important match that you have to take atmosphere and what the match meant into consideration also. So
100% takes it up a level.
So yeah, absolutely. So from that perspective, it's one of the, it's a very historical match, and there's no denying that. And they just went out there and they fucking killed it, and they let it all hang out. And it really did. You know, Gabe Sapolsky, who you mentioned earlier, is a person who, you know, he's always looking for the next thing too, because he learned under the tutelage of Paul Heyman. So, you know, whether it was, you know, having the idea of the grapple fuck style, which I have dubbed it accidentally, that was no intent. I in passing, I called it grapple fuck on one of our podcasts, and now people have dubbed the new grappling style of wrestling grapple fuck. So that was totally by accident, and it wasn't even meant to be slanderous, because it came from MMA. I mean, you know, when a wrestler gets in there with a striker and wrestles them, you know, and wrestles a
decision out. George St. Pierre.
Yeah, it's called wrestle fucking. I mean, that's where the grapple fuck thing came from when I threw it out there. But anyway, I digress. What was I talking about? Sapolsky. He's a guy who's always looking for the next thing. And, you know, I think that match influenced him probably more than anybody else, because that's where he got the idea for the absolutely failed Faction Wars, which came about, I don't know, what, a year later? A year or two later? Maybe 2008?
A year. No, it was 2007.
2007. So he tried Faction Wars after that. Dragon Gate USA does not happen without that six-man in Chicago. Faction Wars does not happen. Dragon Gate's popularity in the West does not happen without that Dragon Gate six-man. And the style of work, of course, was influential from that point forward. We're talking about independent wrestlers or anything else to talk about. So an enormously important match, and I think you're absolutely right. I cannot think of anything since, that was 2006, which gave the wrestling world the same level of kick in the ass that that match gave the wrestling world.
Absolutely, yeah. It was, I remember Dave being on, I guess because Figure Four would have been, this website would have been a year in existence at that point, and I can't remember if it was on a IATA show or if it was on one of the shows of Brian on this website that Dave came on, and he was talking about how this match was the future of wrestling, and like I think people slated him for going way too overboard or whatever with it, but I don't know, I think it was a very fair point to make, and that he was blown away by what he saw, and he obviously hadn't had too much experience seeing that stuff that those guys did, and when he saw it get over to the level he did, I think he was perfectly reasonable for him to put the amount of praise on that match that he did. And I had just started dipping my toe into Dragon Gate and Toriumon about 3-4 months earlier. I remember it was that Christmas that I got sent a bunch of Dragon Gate and Toriumon stuff as part of the board Secret Santa, and it was back in like the first year of the website, and there was only like 50 of us probably on the board then, and it was all like really cool guys at the start, and we did like a Secret Santa with, I don't know, maybe 30 people or whatever it might have been at most, and the guy who got me was he had been watching Toriumon and Dragon Gate for I actually talked about him recently on one of these shows, but Michael Smith, I'll give him a shout. I don't think he's still much on the scene anymore, but he was a huge Toriumon expert, and that he picked out a bunch of their best shows, and he sent them over to me, and I dug into it, and I absolutely I loved it, and I was getting real into it those the first quarter of 2006, and then I saw those guys were announced for WrestleMania weekend, and I was like, oh god, I can't wait to see what they're going to be like in Ring of Honor, and then hearing how they did, and then just all immediately those DVDs became like, I was probably checking the post every day from the day after I ordered it, defying all logic that something from America could get to Ireland within a day. But I'd say the day after I ordered those DVDs on RHWrestling.com, I was probably checking my mailbox every day since or after that. And whatever I was doing the day those DVDs arrived got dropped fast, and I started watching them, and that match certainly delivered. But it was incredible, and it certainly only strengthened what was the early years of my Dragon Gate fandom. Like I said at the start, it's that match and what those guys were doing and what they've gone to do over recent years. I just, for me, I find it hard to see what the next level athletically this thing can be taken to past that. But I hope someone can do it. I really look forward to seeing it. But we're due, like you said. But before I go into my closing point, is there anything you wanted to say on any of that, Joe?
Well, I was hoping that your Dragon Gate DVD story was going to end that with that it was Sid who sent you the DVDs. But unfortunately,
if I got Sid in a Secret Santa, I wonder what I'd get him.
What do you get the man who rules the world? I mean, I think Squeegee is a little too hack, you know?
Yeah, a little too
hack. I don't think you can go Squeegee because that's just a little too hack.
What did he stab Arn with? Was it just a knife?
Scissors. It was scissors.
Wasn't it?
So you can't go Squeegee and you can't go scissors. That's you know, that's...
Maybe a pair of safety scissors, you know, like the plastic scissors?
that's not bad. Might still be a little too hack, but that would be better than a standard scissor, I think. I don't know. What do you get the man who rules the world, who hails from wherever he damn well pleases? I mean, you would think that a man like that has everything he needs. I mean, you're not going to get him a softball bat. Again, it's too hacky. You can't get him a softball bat. So I don't know. I don't know what you get a Sid, but, you know, one quick thing about the Dragon Gate six-man is that for someone like – I was someone like you who had just begun to dip the toes, so to speak, with the Dragon Gate stuff. And, you know, even knowing sort of what I was going to get, and even with being, you know, just inundated with the ridiculous, you know, crazy over-the-top reviews that the match got, when I finally got my hands on the DVD, which wasn't until – a significant amount of time later, because, you know, I think I bought it at a ROH show, if I'm not mistaken. And you know what the turnaround times were like. I don't know when the hell I ended up finally getting it.
It was 2 to 3 months. Like, I know when I got it, it would have been June or July. I remember specifically it was during the World Cup of that year, because I think what I ended up dropping to watch it was an Argentina match during the World Cup. There's my ridiculous memory coming in play.
That's incredible memory.
I think Argentina were playing someone, and the post came, and it was my DVDs. And I was like, fuck Argentina. I'm watching Ring of Honor.
Yeah. So by the time I got it, I was well aware, you know, my expectations were, you know, set sky high, and it's still blew me the fuck away, even with all of that working against it. So, you know, just an amazing match. So
the closing thought that I have is, yes, wrestling has lacked that oh my god thing to come along in recent years, and it seems to be lacking it for the foreseeable future. Like we said, unless it comes out of left field, we don't see where it's coming from. But in lieu of that, what I think wrestling has right now, which and I know people will vehemently disagree with this, and this could be a case of what I talked about earlier, with maybe me being more of a pushing the now rather than the past kind of a guy. I'm more of a living in the now. Like, hey, I love watching old wrestling, but I am not shy in praising and lauding things that happen right now as being up there with the greatest things of all time.
Absolutely, right there with you. You know that.
I'm not deathly afraid to call a match that happens this week as good as Misawa Kawada from 1994.
Right.
If I feel it is, then it is. So, but anyway.
Or in my case, something, and I don't know if you agree with this, or something that happened in 1979, just not holding up and being complete and utter shit by the time I get my eyes on it. I'm not afraid to do that either. But, you know, because it's just, the shit has changed, man. I mean, we've moved forward. We just did 2 hours of things that move things forward.
The more, like, older stuff I watch, it's more, oh, hey, that was a lot of fun. But in terms of great, like, when I think of the 80s, people will kill me for this, but when I think the 80s U.S., so you're talking NWA, Mid-South, all that stuff. When I think of, like, great matches that I would have in, like, a top 5 match of the year list, like, everyone knows my match of the year tracking list, I know now. When I think of matches that would have happened, that I've seen that happened in that decade that would hit a top 5 in one of my current recent year match of the year lists, I can only think of a handful. A handful. Like, your Magnum Tully cage match, I think, is just amazing. There's a Jim Duggan Buzz Sawyer match from Mid South. It's one of my all time favorite matches. Flair Terry Funk, a handful of others. But in general, the stuff I really like from the 80s, I just think, hey, that's really fun. There's two good performers doing the stuff that's really enjoyable to watch, rather than that was a great, great match. And then there's a lot of matches that I'm like, that's not the greatest. It's kind of boring. That's a little too simple for my style, for my taste,
I'll take the heat off of you and put all of the heat on me with my next statement, okay? If you go back and watch Starrcade 83, which you can watch on your WWE Network for $9.99, okay? You can watch that. You can't watch When Worlds Collide, unfortunately, but you can watch Starrcade 83, okay? You go back and watch Starrcade 83, which is a famous show for a number of reasons. With the passing of Roddy Piper recently, obviously that's where they had the famous dog collar match with Greg Valentine. You had Flair.
That is, I will say, I do think that's a very good match.
Absolutely. You have Flair beating Race for the title with the awful Gene Kaniski as the referee, just an awful performance by Kaniski. And to me, also not a very good match, the Flair.
Me neither. I honestly can say I've yet to see a Harley Race match that I thought was, if you want to bust out star ratings, past 3 stars.
I get Harley Race, but I don't get Harley Race. Does that make any sense? I understand the appeal, but he does not appeal to me. I think he stinks. The idea
of Harley Race, the mean, nasty, tough, just, you know, the idea of Harley Race, incredibly appealing to me.
Yes.
The idea of watching a 22-minute Harley Race match, not appealing to me whatsoever. I watched the Andre the Giant match. I talked about it here on the show with Dean a couple of weeks ago. We watched that Harley Race match in NWA Classics. Didn't do a lot for me. And after watching, and honestly, I had not heard anyone talk about that before I watched it. So I wasn't going in trying to be an outlier or contrarian to different opinions. That's not my style anyway. Betting people let me know, and I'm not about that. But we said what we said about that match was being less than enthused. I heard people on other podcasts talking about how it was incredible. And I forget who, I think it was Bix, and maybe Dylan, and I forget who else, but it was a couple of people talking about this match being incredible, and I was just like, I didn't see it, but hey, different strokes.
I'll take Dick Togo over Harley Race any day of the week, but...
Dick motherfucking Togo.
Dick motherfucking Togo, but I'll make the point I was going to make, which will take all the heat off you, and people are going to murder me for this one. But you take Starrcade 83, which I don't think anybody thinks is a great show up and down the card. I don't think it has any kind of reputation for being a great show, but I think it's 1983. You know what I mean? It has a nice cross-section of guys from across the country and across the world, really. It's a historical show that people know about. I'll go on record and say, I don't know, how many guys – 1, 2, 3, 4 – right on the air I'm going to count this out. 2, 4, 8, 10, 14. There's about, I don't know, 22 guys on Starrcade 83. There's probably – 80% of the people who work that show wouldn't get booked on a high-level indie show in 2015. I mean, they're just not good enough. And it doesn't mean that they weren't good enough for 1983. Of course they were. They were more than adequate enough for 1983. You can only judge people against their own era. And for their own era, these guys were fine. But if you gave these guys the magical Chikara fucking time machine and you stuck them in it and you brought them to 2015, you tell me who the hell is booking Johnny Weaver in 2015? I mean, the guy wouldn't get booked on a decent indie show. I mean, he just wouldn't. I mean, you know, people are going to kill me for this one too, but it's like, you know, who's booking Jimmy Valiant in 2015? If he gets booked, he's going to be an opening match comedy guy. Can we be realistic? Things progress. Things move forward. The Assassins aren't getting booked anywhere in 2015. They stink. Can we be honest? Rufus R. Jones is getting booked in 2015. Give me a break, okay? I'm going to tell you who would get booked in 2015 off of Starrcade 83. I'm going to tell you right now, based on their performances in that place and time. Who? Roddy Piper, Ric Flair, and Ricky Steamboat would be stars in 2015, okay? Greg Valentine would get booked anywhere he wanted in 2015. Even though I'm not the biggest Greg Valentine fan, I recognize that the guy was talented.
Greg Valentine would be getting an Evolve title shot against him.
Absolutely. Greg Valentine, before he got lazy in WWE.
And I'd like to see that match, quite frankly.
Okay, Jay Youngblood might get booked in 2015. I'll give him the benefit of doubt because the Steamboat Youngblood team was a great team. Okay, that team would get booked in 2015. Other than that, I would argue about some of these guys, and I would vehemently argue and disagree with you if you tried to make a case for half the guys on this show. I mean, they just don't – we've progressed. Wrestling is constantly moving forward, and it's just wrestling – It's 1983 was fine in 1983, but go watch these matches.
And
they're just shit.
Same,
they're shit.
On the other side of the coin, what do people in 1983 think if you take Uha Nation of 2015 and put him into that same time machine, have him go the other direction and stick him on that card?
He'd be the most in-demand wrestler in the world. In the world! There's no question! Forget Ulan. What if Dolph Ziggler went to 1983? Every territory in the country would want to make him the champion. Are you kidding me? And it's like he's firmly a mid-carder who half the people now can't stand. The standards have changed. And it's I don't even think what I'm saying is particularly controversial. But the fact of the matter is, you know, people will find that insulting. Or, you know, they'll disagree with it. I don't know. To me, it's common sense. Everything progresses. Music, movies, athletes, wrestling. And, you know, I don't want to delve too far from the topic here, but, that Abdul the Butcher Carlos Colon match on Starrcade 83, if that was on, and look, no one is claiming that was a good match in real time either. So maybe that's not fair. But whether it's that match or whether it's the any of those prelim matches on that show, and even the Steamboat and Youngblood versus Briscoe Brothers match. I mean, you put that Steamboat and Youngblood versus Briscoe, washed up Briscoe Brothers, okay, 1983 Briscoe Brothers, fine. You put that match on a major show now, nobody thinks that's a great match. I mean, that match gets ripped for being terrible if you put that on a show now. I'm sorry, it just does. So if you put that on a high-level indie, you put that on a decent AAW show, and it's getting laughed out of the building. So, I mean, you know, there you go, Alan. I just took all the heat off of you because I'm definitely prepared for that little diatribe that I just went on.
Well, I'm not sure exactly how it was going to lead into my last point. I started in some way and we got sidetracked there, but the point I was going to get at is that now, in lieu of not having these new crazy things popping up like all the things we've talked about, I think what we have now is a situation where we have a group of wrestlers that have, and I mean worldwide when I talk this, your Okada to your Nick Jackson to your Dolph Ziggler, spanning the world here. We have a group of wrestlers who are more well-versed, more well-educated, more well-researched, more experienced in different styles, working with different people who have experienced different styles. The best guys are so good now, and there's so many of them, that we are seeing, because if things did get to a peak with Dragon Gate in the mid-2000s, in the 10 years since then, all that had happened before, that everything we've talked about on this show has been consumed by all these wrestlers, and even if it hasn't been by a specific wrestler, they learn from another wrestler, they wrestle, it just pervades the whole thing. And if you get enough good athletes, which we do have enough good athletes out there now, and enough people that want to excel, and we do have enough people that want to excel, we're at a point now in 2015 where I reference my match of the year tracking list, but I'd have to go and check, but God, I'll be damned if I don't get the feeling that every year that thing gets longer. And trust me, I'm not becoming an easier marker, because I go back and look at some ratings I gave to things 8 years ago, and I'm like, hey, that was probably a bit generous. I think I'm a harsher marker now than I was 7, 8 years ago, because I've seen so much more, so it takes more to impress me. But I'll be damned if my list doesn't keep getting bigger. There's more great wrestling matches happening in the world right now than ever before.
1,000% agree.
You got the G1 knocking all these great matches out of the park. Like Dave Meltzer is talking about this. I disagree with him, and I'm not going to go on this tangent, but because I respect Dave too much to rip him apart from this. It's his opinion, and I respect it. He's talking about this being a disappointing G1. If you look at his match ratings that he's going to have when this G1's over, they may not be as high as the match ratings I'm given. But then again, actually, Dave went 4.5 for Shinsuke Ishii. I didn't even give that 4. So you never know. But like, I've given 4 matches 4.75 stars so far in this G1. Goto Ishii. Tanahashi, Ibushi.
Let me tell you something, Alan. Do you know why he's considering this a disappointing G1? I'm going to tell you why. Because it is a disappointing G1, because the bar had been raised so high and things have progressed so far over the last couple of years that compared to the last 2 years, it probably is a disappointing G1.
I'm going to disagree, because I think Dave, but again, he's entitled to look at it the way he's looking at it. And I think I understand the point of when you look at the shows on the whole, it is certainly more diluted. It is a way more diluted G1 than the last two. But if you look in terms of the G1 matches and how many great, I think we're getting as many great, maybe not as last year, but we're getting as many great matches as we got 2 years ago. And, yeah, I think when it's all said and done and we've got through these Corkin and Sumo Hall shows, like tomorrow morning we're going to have a few more matches on the 4-star plus level. So, yeah, it's for me, it's not disappointing, but that's because I knew what I was getting into with this G1. I knew it was going to be longer. I knew it was going to be more diluted with all the tag matches, and each show to show wasn't a singular show wasn't going to be as good as the best singular shows from 2 years ago. But on the whole, when it was all said and done, I was thinking we're going to have just as many great matches because we've got all the same guys and more. Elgin's overachieving. And plus, now with the way they're doing it this year, you've got these longer developing stories that have been kind of evolving throughout the tournament, which like Naito and stuff like that. So for me, it hasn't been a disappointing game.
I understand why people call it disappointing, because nothing. Look, I didn't think anything would top 2013, and then 2014 somehow topped 2013, and 2014 is almost universally recognized as the greatest pro wrestling tournament of all time. How can you match that? I'm looking at my sheet now. I've got as we record this, there's four shows left. The four biggest shows, by the way, where they're really going to let it all hang out. And I think the Sumo Hall shows are going to blow people away. But with four shows remaining, I already have 20 matches at 4 stars or better. So, you know, disappointing is a relative term here. I mean, if we use our Chikara time machine and stick this tournament in 1983, it's legendary beyond belief. This G1 tournament is legendary beyond belief. If it takes place, could you imagine if this tournament took place in 1983? And that's why in 2015, a lot of people are calling this disappointing. You put it in 1983, and it's and people would be talking about today like nothing could possibly top it. Why? Because we've progressed and the standards have changed. So we've come full circle.
You got this tournament happening now in a week or two. You've got Battle of Los Angeles with all the matches that's going to produce. Next weekend, the weekend after, you've got a big WWE weekend in Ring of Honor with those shows, three big shows in Brooklyn, SummerSlam and the NXT show with the big ladder match and the Ring of Honor show, which is a stacked card. Over in England, like look at the next show Rev Pro we're going to do. Progress are churning out great shows, great matches. You've got Ultima Lucha having just finished with like these raved about matches on the final show. Dragon Gate have just come off a great cork, and then they've got a big pay-per-view with Shingo against Yoshino, which, goddamn, Shingo versus Yoshino. I'm not the biggest fan of the world of those two guys. I'm not even thinking about that match yet. It's not even on my radar yet. And that could end up being the best match of the year for me. Who knows?
Alan,
it's like all these things happening within like a six-week period. It's ridiculous.
I'll go a step further. You're naming all the stuff that we all know is going to be great that's happening right now and going on. I just watched a three-way match on Raw last night between Cesaro, Randy Orton, and Kevin Owens. That would have been
I haven't seen it yet.
That would have been the best match on 90% of the shows in 1983. Without question. I have no doubt in my mind that three-way match I watched on Raw last night, which was a nice little match that won't even sniff my top 10 or top 20 of the year, by the way, in 2015. That would have been the best match on 90% of the pro wrestling shows in the United States in 1983, without question.
Hell, move that forward. Move that to 2003.
You're right. I mean, the percentages go down the further you move. But wrestling to me is constantly getting better. And to be fair to 1983 blows 1963 out of the water.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is, man. Time does not stand still for anybody, okay? Time constantly moves forward. Things constantly get better, progress, and evolve. And
here's the perfect way of summing up everything we've said today. With each of those bullet points we talked about, the Joshi, the AAA, the Michinoku Pro, the ECW, the Loki and Danielson, Rise of the Indies. With every one of those that we talked about, that just gave more ammunition for the wrestlers that were coming up to evolve the craft and give us more opportunity for more great matches. And now, in 2015... I think we both would categorically say, without a shadow of a doubt, on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, in the world of pro wrestling, there's more great matches happening than ever before.
Alan, I've got nothing to add. You just said in about 15 seconds what I've been trying to say on the Voices of Wrestling podcast for 3 years, and you said it better than I ever could have put it. You're absolutely right.
So, a successful attempt at breaking in
Glad we closed the book on this debate. So, you know, I'm sure no one will have anything to say now that we've dusted this one off.
It's I know your debate that you've had, and I think when you've debated that with people, and I know you and Dylan who Dylan's a guy who's been on this show, and like I love listening to Dylan talk about wrestling, and I know you're on opposite sides of the coin. Whenever when I see you guys going back and forth on this, I generally don't read too much of it, but because from what I see, it's like I think you're kind of looking at two different things and talking about two different things. I don't think you're really arguing the same point, but so I don't want this to be seen as an attack on other people's opinion, because I'm not entirely sure if what we're talking about is something that people vehemently disagree with. I think people's just looking at things a slightly different way. But I don't know. Maybe people do take this, what we've said in the last, like, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes.
Who are you kidding? And you're telling me pro wrestling fans aren't going to take slights at things? Give me a break. Of course they're. Who are you? What kind of Pollyanna world are you trying to live in? Jeez. But yeah. But I get along with Dylan just fine. I mean, I get under his skin sometimes, and which, you know, is pretty obvious, and he gets under my skin at times. But, as like you said, there's very few people I'd rather talk wrestling with, even if we're diametrically opposed on most of the topics that we come across. People would be surprised, though, and he would admit this, too, if you got him in the right mood. Me and Dylan agree on way more things than people think we do. So it's just the things that we disagree on, we couldn't be further opposed.
That aside, I think it's a thesis, as you said earlier, like not necessarily all these things we talked about, not everyone's going to be was in love with the rise of AAA. Not everyone was in love with ECW. And all these things were pretty they were shocking and eye-catching, but they wouldn't have been everyone's cup of tea, and that's totally fine. I think myself and yourself and a lot of people were in the position for when these things came along. We were the right people to be grabbed by them, and a lot of other people were too. And I can't wait to see what the next one will be. I want to share your optimism that it's coming, but I don't see where it's coming from. But if it's not gonna come in my lifetime or your lifetime, Joe, at least in lieu of that, we're getting some of the best wrestling. One of the things that, just last side tangent, I really enjoyed the other day when we get so much of this stuff is kind of blend together, and it's kind of led to, like, you watch a PWG show, you watch a Rev Pro show, or you get, there's a bit of sameness in terms of all these wrestlers because of this globalization thing. A lot of guys, like, you'll see a certain spots you'll see in there. And that's always been a thing. Like, I remember 10 years ago, people were always told me you'd see a lung blower in every match, or shining wizard, whatever. But, one of the things I really liked the other day was, Tanahashi and Shibata just having a real old school, just wrestling match, but like modernized in a way, and just really, really, keeping it simple, but keeping the intensity and aggression. I want to see just a bit more kind of different things mixed in as well, just so it doesn't get too samey. But we certainly are, even in the way where things are a bit samey, we're still getting so many great matches. So and I'm still able to enjoy them, even though you see, like, hey, like, we all love Tomohiro Ishii, but a lot of his great matches are quite similar to each other. He's just really good at doing them. But, seeing different things mixed in always helps. But that's the last little side tangent. I think it's time to get out of here, Joe.
Hey, man, you're running the show. You tell me. I can go all night. All night. I am known in many circles as All Night Lanza.
Tinder Ant Lanza, All Night Lanza. All kinds of nicknames, but you most certainly live up to your not your nickname, your well earned title of internationally acclaimed broadcast journalist, Joe Lanza. Is that it?
Did you happen to hear me on BBC Radio?
I did. I woke up that morning and I saw the tweets. I was like, what the fuck? And then I was looking up when you posted a tweet of being like, I'll be on in like 45 minutes, and it was like about an hour and a half before that. So I was like, I must have missed it, but then I checked on the BBC website and the Five Live website, and I was like, oh, that's cool. They'll have everything up on demand right after. So I'll just wait a couple of hours and check it out, which I did. And I got to ask, how did it come about?
You know, I shockingly didn't cause an international incident, which
you were really good.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I really loved the one moment of, like, because you were very professional. You're very, not that you're not professional all the time, Joe, but I mean, you were very, you didn't let out your inner Joe Lanza.
I understood that this was no time for the Joe Lanza antics.
You weren't about to jump into your impression of Fake Taxi on the air with the British. But the one thing that kind of where my favorite Joe Lanza just kind of crept out for a little bit was for me. That term you used was like, you see the problem with Dennis Rodman is Dennis Rodman's got no credibility. Just so bluntly, I love that.
Hey,
that was brilliant.
Hey, look, you're gonna bring Joe Lanza on your radio program. You know that you're gonna get that kind of bluntness, Alan. So hopefully I delivered for the BBC, and you know, this was not a good thing for my ego though, because I will not shut the hell up about it.
Did they look for Rich, and Rich wasn't able, and
I am not going to divulge the details of how it came about.
Okay, that's fair. Okay? That's fair.
All I'm going to say is they could have had Dave Meltzer, they could have had Wade Keller, they could have had Mike Johnson, they could have had a number of individuals, but they asked for Joe Lanza, and Alan, that's really all that matters right now.
Sounds good to me. But Joe, any plugs? Of course, Voices of Wrestling. Let people know what's going on there right now.
VoicesofWrestling.com. You know, I don't even know what the hell is going on there anymore, because we probably
there is a lot.
Listen,
busy bees.
Right on our front page as I speak, just to show you the kind of diversity. I mean, our goal is to cover everything, and we really do try. Of course, the G1 coverage, which people have come to know us for the last
Rob McCarron's videos. We've talked about Rob McCarron's videos on this show the last 2 weeks with Joey Bay. How impressed we've been with those videos. Really great work from Rob there.
Yeah, unfortunately we hit a copyright snag with the videos. I don't know if you've seen, but
oh no,
yeah, we had.
Wait, I did see on my watch later list on YouTube. I noticed there was a deleted video, and I went to see what it was, and it was by just like copying and pasting the links, and it was, yeah, I was wondering, I was like, maybe they just re-uploaded it onto a different, but yeah, you get to take them all down?
All of the old ones were pulled for copyright claims, so they're dead and gone. We don't know if it was New Japan or if it was Samurai, we don't know who, but we are trying to rectify it, and we're getting in touch with the people we need to get in touch with, so it is possible that we can cut some sort of deal with the appropriate parties. We'll see. I don't want to say much more.
Yeah, I just, because I know you guys were using the clips, I just assumed it was like a fair use kind of a
That's
thing.
That's kind of what we thought. We were kind of just winging it. Look, we're not upset that it got pulled. It's not our content. So yeah, you can't complain. So we're not mad about it. We're not angry at anybody. We knew it was a possibility. We were using short clips from the G1. Somebody found out about it and had them pulled. It is what it is. But Rob is still doing the videos just without the clips. We're using still photos. He's still using the tremendous production that he's been using. We're still showing the standings and all that. You still get a lot of the bells and whistles. We just don't have those short 5 to 8 second clips of the matches. So, in fact, he just put up a new video today as we record this on the 11th. So, and we will continue to do the videos for the duration of the tournament, plus all of the reviews. Joe Lanza stepping in and doing all the Sumo Hall shows, okay? So,
Ooh. Listen,
you know, Brian Rose, Rob McCarron, Rich Krejci, those guys, they did a tremendous job early on. I did a few as well. But Joe Lanza will be there to do the Sumo Hall reviews, okay? So
big time. Absolutely. You know it's a big show then.
That's right. So we'll have all the reviews. Rich has done a tremendous job with the written previews for each night as well. I think that's been overlooked. Setting everybody up, letting everybody know how many points everybody has coming into the matches, giving the histories between the two participants. Those have been very good articles as well. Aside from the G1 coverage, look, people think of us as a New Japan site. I'd say, look, we are not a New Japan site. We are a pro wrestling site. We cover everything. We just happen to rise as sort of New Japan Rose. So, you know, it is what it is, but we cover WWE. We review all of those shows.
The SmackDown review is getting glowing praise.
Drew Gunn, and that, you know, I got
Drew is really a hell of a writer.
One of the things we pride ourselves on at Voice of Wrestling is unearthing some of the more unknown writers around. There's so many quality writers around, and you know, it used to just be me and Rich. We're not afraid to step aside and hand things over to the people who are better than us. And Rugun is a far better writer than either one of us ever will be, and she's killing it on the SmackDown reviews, and they're getting rave reviews all over the internet. I don't cover Dragon Gate anymore. I used to do the Dragon Gate reviews, but listen, the young boy, Case Lowe, he does a much better job than me. So now he covers the Dragon Gate shows. There's no egos here, Alan. Okay?
He had a great column about the millennials up yesterday, I believe it was.
Absolutely, and that's still on our front page. And as I look at our front page, aside from the G1 coverage that many people think it's all that we do, we've got a review of the latest FIP show from August 7th. We have a review from a Scottish indie show on the front page today. We have a review of the Scenic City Invitational by Dylan Hales, who we just brought up a little bit earlier, that took place over this weekend. So a little Southern indie action for you. We have a podcast that can suit anybody's needs. If you want to hear me, I don't know why you'd want to hear more of me, but if you want to hear me and Rich talk about all the topics from across the globe, listen to the Voices of Wrestling flagship podcast. We also have Shake Them Ropes with Rob McCarron and Jeff Hawkins, which is more WWE focused. We have Lucha of the Hidden Temple with the great Chris Novembrino, if you're looking for Lucha Underground content. So there's a podcast for everyone. We try to cover the entire worldwide scope of wrestling, and you should check out the site. Also check out our forums.
I think it's fair to say now, after a few weeks of the forum reboot, I'm amazed. The forums were fun, I found, before the reboot, but I think, like, we set them up and you didn't know how much activity you'd get. And there was a little bit of activity, but I think it was held back, as you guys have admitted, by the forum software you're using. And as soon as you did the reboot and launched it with the new software, which is the same kind of forum software here on the board here, this thing has just taken off. My God, it is. I can't keep up with it. I try and duck in when I get an opportunity at work and see what's going on. I'll make a couple of posts here and there, but I can't even touch like 10% of it, because it's all the threads are popping off, and so much content. So if you still want a good message board to be on in 2015, it's the one to go to.
Listen, and the thing about our board is this: it's light and it's not heavy and it's not moderated at all. But with that said, there's no trolls. Okay, it's a troll-free board. Everyone's just talking wrestling, and listen, when we've got the Cubs fan checking in on all the Lucha threads, and when you've got someone the caliber of Jai checking in on the Dragon Gate thread, you know your board is the real deal, because that guy never crawls out of his cave to post anywhere. Okay, and the Cubs fan is not a guy who's a big time forum poster. So we've got all the experts for all these various promotions posting in the threads as well. Very intelligent conversations on all the worldwide promotions, and we think it's a really great place.
Rob Reed doing a great job on British wrestling, and Rob Reed's trivia, which I just filled out my PWG trivia today. I think I nailed that one. That's fun there to do as well. And you got the Match in a Month balloting, loads of stuff going on.
Yeah, Match of the Month too. Listen, I used to be a master of these plugs. I don't even know anymore. There's so much going on this site. You know, I'm so out of the loop anymore. I don't even know what's on the site until I turn the thing on. So, but yeah, just check it out, voicesofwrestling.com. We will probably, Rich, you know, this guy with his 7-8 vacations per year, we've missed a few weeks with the flagship podcast over the last 6 weeks or so, but we're back on schedule. We had a show last week where we broke down Wrestle 1, of all things. What other podcast are you going to get where there's an intense breakdown of Wrestle 1, and it's the lead topic? So we should have another show this week. And we're also trying to ramp up our interviews again. Rob McCarron's done a great job with that. We talked about the Matt Cross interview earlier on this show. We have an entire catalog and database of interviews that we've done in the past. So check that out as well. I think that's just about everything, Alan. Let's get the hell out of here, man.
Let's get the hell out of here. I need to go to bed. I'll try and upload the show before I do. But yeah. Guys, thank you very much for listening. This show was a blast to do. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I hope we were able to put into words what we had in our head. And I hope you're able to take some enjoyment. Let us know your thoughts. Give us your feedback on points we made that you agreed with, disagreed with, your experiences with any of the things historically that we talked about. And looking forward to hearing from people on this one. I hope you all enjoyed it, and check out all the content here at f4wonline.com as well. I think I'm in two minds. I have to check when I did my last free show, see if it's okay to put this up as a free show. But if this is a free show and you are listening to it and you're not a subscriber, loads of great content to check out here. The home of everything Dave Meltzer. So Dave on the radio, Dave in the newsletter, all the other shows on the website. Figure Four Weekly, which I've been writing the Japan stuff in for about a year now, maybe a little longer. Probably actually closer to 2 years. And David Bixenspan's been doing a great job at the lead stories in Figure Four. There was a free issue, I think, 2 weeks ago. So if you want to check that out to kind of give yourself more of a sample of what's on offer here on the site before making your decision, please do. And until then, we'll be back here on the DKP with a G1 wrap-up panel this weekend after the final show. So I know you guys will be doing a show after the G1 on Voice of Wrestling at some point. So there'll be loads of breakdowns of the G1 for people to listen to in the coming days. So bye, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Joe.
うちのは本当に